system to be turned on, and then we'll get started here.
Mr. Chair, I'm really impressed with the Senate starting on time here.
Welcome to the Senate, Representative Hornstein.
It's the new Senate.
Yeah, you notice there's just me sitting there.
And once again, we got a better turnout from the House than the Senate. Maybe I should have waited a few minutes. Thank you, everyone. This is the joint hearing of the Senate Transportation and Public Safety Finance Division with the House Transportation Finance Committee of Tuesday, February 18th. 1 o'clock, room 15 of the state capitol. Today, members and members of the public, we're going to build on the committee meeting that we had last week, talking about transportation and the needs and the challenges that we heard so well last week, and hear a little bit more about the opportunities and the opportunity that we have in front of us starting a week from today when we go back into session. And we're going to hear some specific ideas that folks have put together and are starting to coalesce around that we'll be able to consider in a more formal fashion once we're actually in session. You have the agenda in front of you. We do have a few folks who have signed up ahead of time to testify in the third part. I understand there's a couple of folks from the public who weren't able to call a day or two ago. And so just please let someone know how we're handling that. But the folks who want to testify who haven't made the list.
We know of three of them.
Yeah, we know of three of you. So we'll call your names, and then we'll open it up a little bit. But we're going to try to get out of here in couple of hours. So with that, we're going to start off with a presentation from our commissioner again this week, and we're going to hear a bit about ideas around efficiency, transparency, and accountability. MnDOT has been working on some of those items for a couple of years since the 2008 bill and has some ideas moving forward. And then we're here from Eric Sundquist from the State Smart Transportation Initiative. So with that, Mr. Chair, do you have any?
No, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank everybody for coming to the hearing. This is another great turnout. We had standing room only when we were over in the state office building and here again at the Capitol, and I think this speaks to the urgency of the issue we're dealing with and how transportation just affects so many people's lives so profoundly. And so your presence here makes a huge difference, and I appreciate everybody coming today. And it's wonderful always to see the commissioner.
A couple of announcements. Mr. Commissioner. Members, we're on TV again, so please, little signals that you have to your mom, feel free to make those. And no vicious gossip, because you'll be picked up on the microphones and it'll be on TV forever, so don't say any unkind things about me. The materials that have been handed out that are in your packet, this is for the public, the viewing public. They are posted on the Senate Committee website. I think there was some confusion about where exactly you find those on the Senate Committee website. You have to go under the calendar for the day and then click on today's hearing, and then you find the materials posted there. So you can pull those up and follow along as we're looking at those pieces of paper during the hearing. And then members, I'll try to remember if we get so many members attending that are sitting on the inside, we have to see those little microphones, those little black things. Just remind me to ask those folks to pick those up and speak into them so that they get picked up by the TV. Now we can commence. Commissioner Zelli.
Thank you, Chairman Dibble and Chairman Ornstein. It is an honor and a pleasure to be back a week later after our last testimony. And also thank you to everybody who's attending, both live and through the TV. It has certainly impressed the MnDOT employees I walked in with to see so many people here interested in transportation. And of course, we are, and realizing that transportation is becoming a top-tier issue in our state, not because of transportation itself, but because it's inextricably connected to the issues and matters that Minnesotans most care about, our livability, our economy, and our environment. But we're here specifically to talk about transportation and accountability. And so there's some things that I've spoken to this committee, these joint committees before in the past, but I'm just going to expand on it and maybe introduce a few details. Knowing that many efforts toward some efficiency and innovation have been happening at MnDOT for some time, it's kind of a nice point for me to kind of talk about where we've been over the past few years and what the prospects are in the future. I think many people have heard that we are working with the business community to help develop a pathway toward even greater efficiency and transparency, building on the past efforts. Knowing that there's a funding gap, there's a pretty well-talked-about capital shortfall of as much as $12 billion over the next 20 years. And I have been able to embrace the idea that we will deliver at least 15% of that gap through future efficiencies and innovation. So in a sense, funding part of that shortfall through our own work toward making sure we're making the smart investments, doing them in a cost-efficient manner. As you know, this comes not in one little place like reducing headcounts. It comes from a very thoughtful practice, not dissimilar to many in the private sector, and I clearly have a bias as a simple bus guy, knowing how to meet a payroll and to plan for our capital investments in the future. It comes from a lot of different initiatives, and I'm going to touch on a number of them today. This is, in a sense, a $3 billion a year enterprise, and it needs to be not like a private company, but many of the practices toward efficiencies, I think we might actually apply. But first, the perfect storm that's coming. We've talked about a lot of this, but just to kind of frame it appropriately, we're losing a lot of our purchasing power because of our funding sources are tied to a gas tax, a fixed gas tax. And as more fuel-efficient cars come into play and highway construction and costs of asphalt and salt increases, we're falling behind. Also, to know that we have a debt ceiling limit. We talked about this last week, that we will be brushing up against 20% of our annual revenues associated with that trunk highway fund. We'll be hitting that in a couple of years just with the projects that are currently programmed and underway. The Federal Highway Trust Fund cannot be really looked at as additional sources of funding for the state of Minnesota, and I'll get to that in a minute. And, of course, we're reaching a period of time where our aging system is going to cost us more. 50% of our pavements are over 50 years old. And not to mention the changing, well, to mention the changing demographics, the 1 million people coming to our state with different kind of lifestyle and freight increases over the next 10 to 20 years will cause tremendous demand on the highway system. So here's just a quick graph that many people have seen. It shows that over the next 20 years, we would expect a 30% loss in our purchasing power from our construction and operations budgets. And then this is the debt ceiling limit. You can see how a lot of the projects that have been undertaken over the past 4 to 5 years have been funded with trunk highway bonds. And with this last corridors of commerce funding, we have really reached the edge of that limit. And I think this graph says it best, where the federal trust fund is really running into the red sometime around, I am told, August, toward the even before the end of the federal fiscal year. MnDOT's projection over the next 20 years assumes fairly level funding from the federal government, and many have said that is an optimistic view. We certainly are not forecasting an increase. So just a couple of comments on life cycle costs. As you can see from the pictures here, there's a road with significant cracks and filled in potholes. A lot of our increase in costs in the years ahead could be attributable to not sufficient enough investment at critical times of the asset, whether it's a true for bridges as well as pavements. In order to make the greatest, most productive use of any asset, particularly a road, refurbishment and proper kind of reconstruction, which is less expensive over the 50-year time horizon of a road, if it is done at times when the major parts of the road can be withheld. We have many roads in Minnesota where we've gone beyond this point, where putting kind of thin overlays or major or slight Band-Aid fixes will only last a couple of years. If we miss the window of proper refurbishment, you will actually cost taxpayers more over time by not making the critical investments at the right time. So I want to get into where we actually have applied some, I think, efficiency and proper investments. And I will talk about several different projects as way of an example. And all this can kind of be wrapped up in the idea of a performance-based design or best value. There was at a time when you, in order to do an interchange, when two major interstates come together, you build a four-leaf, a cloverleaf. Well, when we built 169 and 494, we found a way to actually deliver the traffic performance with only six lanes, not the full eight, and saving as much as $40 million. The reason that's significant is by actually designing projects to meet the traffic or the safety or the economic performance, it is not dictated by just simply this is the design. It is what are we trying to accomplish, and then let's build the most practical, the most cost-effective design for that project. In the case of 169 and 494, we were able to meet 90% of the traffic need and free up mobility with a much more cost-effective solution. And we think, or we've been told, that some new businesses, especially most notably Shutterfly, came into the area in Shakopee as a result of this project, which perhaps might not have been afforded had we had the full-scale interchange. And we have a picture here of the Hastings Bridge. The Hastings Bridge was built on the side of the river, and we've certainly shown this video of the bridge actually being floated into place. But what's significant about it is not just that this is a 100-year bridge with new technology. It was designed, a design build, to meet the special kind of expansion from two lanes to four lanes. But what is partly significant is that we saved about 2 years of a 47-mile detour for the public and businesses that use Highway 61 as a major thoroughfare. This bridge needed to be replaced, but the fact that we were replacing it while keeping the existing bridge open was a very significant matter of efficiency and, frankly, cost savings for taxpayers. Likewise, the Maryland Avenue Bridge was built also on the side of the road and resulted in smooth traffic during most of its construction period as well. I'm listing Highway 7. Highway 7 is an example where we actually expanded an additional lane by restriping. I know we get a lot of controversy sometimes about that, but we're actually able to ease congestion, 75% of the congestion, by managing the lanes. Sometimes that's temporary, sometimes it's permanent. But our view is we need to be smart about the dollars we expend to actually get the performance we want. We're in the middle of the St. Croix Crossing project. We'll have more to talk about the efficiencies we have garnered by using this performance-based approach. But I will give you a teaser. We were able to eliminate approximately 45 parcels out of a total of 85 that we had planned to purchase in the course of that project. We've done that in the process of building this bridge. We've saved dollars in the right-of-way. And I look forward, as we gather some of our efficiencies, to actually give you the number in the months ahead, because we think St. Croix is going to be another example of using smart performance-based design to garner greater efficiency. So I've talked a lot in the past 6 months about the overriding objective at MnDOT currently is to enhance our financial effectiveness. We had as much as 100 different initiatives, flagships, goals. We now have one. It is to enhance financial effectiveness. We are not dropping our commitment to safety, our commitment to innovation, but we are agency-wide looking at three particular areas where every person within MnDOT has a responsibility and a commitment to improve. One, financial management, and really being able to track fully allocated costs by our various products and services. This is no different as if we were any construction company or planning company or manufacturing company. We want to be able to understand where our costs are by various products and services. And we have a full commitment and interest from our finance staff, particularly led by our Deputy Commissioner and Chief Financial Officer and Chief Operating Officer Tracy Hatch. Another major initiative is asset management. Asset management really is the issue behind measuring and understanding the life cycle cost and the most prudent time to make investments in our system to save money in the long run. Sadly, in the public sector, we do not actually book depreciation, but depreciation still exists. Every year, our system erodes, and being a simple bus guy, I know to extend the life of an asset, you have to be smart about when those refurbishments are made and how they can be done in a cost-effective way with full intent to extend the life of the asset and save the taxpayers money. We are certainly looking at project management, because not only delivering projects efficiently with cost savings, also delivering them on time has a critical economic effect. So we are looking at projects not just to meet our schedule, but how we can make sure that traffic is not disrupted during to at least as much as possible during the project cycle. If you'll note, we actually are paying more on the Interstate 35 reconstruction through St. Paul. We're paying more in terms of dollars, but we're keeping traffic flowing throughout the process. We think that's of good value for the taxpayers, and even though it is more MnDOT funds, we know that it's part of our efficiency and our commitment to taxpayer benefit. A lot of questions we've gotten is how do we compare and with other states, and how does our workforce align over time? I'm actually thrilled to report that we have not added significant people, even though there have been additional lane miles and our system has grown over the past 5 years. We have gone through an early retirement incentive period a number of years ago, and I can really speak for all employees of MnDOT, where their diligence and hard work is doing the job, whereas before we had more people. When we look at benchmarking, you will see that in looking at our actual costs per lane mile compared to our peers, our adjacent neighbors, we're actually doing okay. We're about middle of the pack, even though we have a much larger system than any other state in our five-state area. And maybe the most important kind of benchmark to look at is just the USA average of roughly $24,000 per lane mile. This is all MnDOT's betting with capital over the life cycle of a road. So it really is making a kind of apples-to-apples comparison. These are numbers that came from the Federal Highway Department. And you'll see that we're well below the USA average, which I think is amazing considering the severity of our weather, and certainly this winter points that out. So thank you. That is an overview, and I'm really looking forward to working with the legislature and business community and other stakeholders at actually kind of publishing a pathway toward efficiency in the years ahead.
Thank you, Commissioner. So questions, members? I saw Representative Hallberg and Representative Peter. You guys can decide who goes first, and then we'll go to Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you can go back to the last slide on the highway spending per lane mile, if you look at what might be considered peer states with North Dakota and South Dakota, similar weather, et cetera, what would account for the nearly one quarter cost of Minnesota costs, if you know?
I can give you my impression, and smarter people at MnDOT may tell me I'm totally wrong. But these are 2011 figures, and having driven in North Dakota and actually own a bus company that goes through it, there were roads that were formerly asphalt that are now gravel in the state of North Dakota. They have made a commitment to rebuild their infrastructure. My guess is if we look at 2013 numbers, I think they've probably come up significantly. And they had been through a period where they had not really invested in their infrastructure, and now with the oil boom, there's a huge a demand on that system, and I just know this anecdotally that they're really trying to catch up.
And if I might, any thoughts on South Dakota or even Iowa? That's at about a little more than half.
You know, I don't know the actual stories behind that, and I think they are very different systems and how they operate. But I can get back to you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner. That would be actually interesting. I mean, we're middle of the pack, but, wow, there's a big gap. Thanks for catching that, Representative Hallberg. So it would be interesting. I saw Ms. Hatch nodding her head vigorously. Did you want to illuminate us? Or?
Please.
You don't have to.
Here's the brains behind the operation. Tracy Hatch, our Deputy Commissioner.
Greetings, Deputy Commissioner. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name, for the record, is Tracy Hatch. I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Chief Financial Officer, and Chief Operating Officer for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I couldn't speak, Representative Hallberg, to specifically between those two states, but we'd be happy to look into that and get back to you. These are statistics that are compiled by the Federal Highway Administration, and so all of our data kind of feeds into that, and then they do more of a peer-to-peer comparison with other states. So we'd be delighted to get back to you, actually, to all the combined committee with that answer. But if I might just add a couple of other comments, this represents both capital and operating spending, and it also represents all roads, not just roads on the state-owned system, but including local, city, and county roads as well.
Thank you. Okay, we're taking a list here. Hands are shooting up, so we'll just kind of keep going around the semicircle here. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman, and you just answered the question. I was wondering if this included all roads, and you just said it did. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the moving more people with less pavement, and I think you specifically talked MinPass, but I'm thinking more what we tried to do on 94 between Minneapolis and St. Paul when you use existing pavement in different ways and buses
right.
on shoulders and all of that. Do we have any accident comparisons in areas where we do that and where we don't do that, where we're trying to move more people with less pavement and versus using full traditional lanes?
I think that's a great question. I don't have, Mr. Chairman, the exact metrics, but we can certainly do track that. So I'm happy, Representative Hausman, to provide that. But it is, you're right, and it's worth talking about, which I didn't really address, although it's in the slide. We are really seeking to manage the capacity of movements of people, and not just vehicles, and by having transit ways and a kind of integrated system with transit particularly in the metro, is very much part of our vision, very much of a shared vision with Met Council. And we know that highways are part of that solution, but free open lanes with single occupancy cars is the least efficient and maybe even not feasible. So the min-pass lanes and using dynamic shoulders is certainly a strategy of which has a very high return on investment given the mobility we achieve. But to know, are we sacrificing safety, which I think is your question, we should get back to you. My understanding is that we haven't, but we want to corroborate that.
So, Commissioner, and for anyone who is needing to respond to questions later, please do so in writing, and then we'll, of course, post it to the committee website so that the public can also benefit from those responses. Right. Thank you. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Zelli, on page 5 on the handout that we have, the slide that's transparency and accountability, number 1, financial management, you talked about a little bit, but I'm interested in maybe if you could tie into the major highway projects and trunk highway fund expenditures report that came out in December of 2013. You list 2 specific problems or challenges with being able to do that. One was that the inability to match budgets to expenses, and then some rollover budget kind of situations. How is that coming, and how is that working?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd be happy to answer that question. As you're probably aware, a couple of years ago, and I think it was in 2012, although the years just seem to run together, but I think it was in 2012, legislation was passed requiring us to budget by products and services. And so we immediately began, you know, trying to work towards that endeavor. We do budget. We just don't budget by products and services as a line item. For example, we currently budget, and currently the accounting system only really allows budgeting in one framework, and that is things like salaries and supplies and equipment and those kind of things, consultant contracts. So it required some system adaptations in order for us to budget by product and service. It also caused me really to take a look, as Chief Financial Officer, at our existing products and services grid. And it's my belief, and I can talk at great length to anyone who's interested in learning more, but it's my belief that the grid that we had at the time is really kind of archaic. It was a grid that was developed at far too detailed of a level, and it was developed at a time when we had accounting systems that couldn't, you know, do any other analysis. The technology we have today is far different, and so we're trying to leverage that to break the budgets down in multiple ways. And so some of this requires a little bit of a change in the way that we manage the data in our warehouse. There's the state data warehouse, and then MnDOT has its own financial data warehouse, as an example. It also caused me to look and determine that we really ought to be doing full cost allocation. We did cost allocation on some products and services and some activities that we would bill, for example, to local units of government, labor, equipment, materials, that kind of thing. But we didn't do holistic cost allocation because the way our program and budget structure was, which is how we receive our funding from the legislature, didn't really provide for that kind of opportunity. We're funded in kind of one lump sum for activities that really ought to be cost allocated to the products and services. So we're trying to do kind of those are two of the main objectives behind this financial management activity. And we're very close to being able to achieve that. And we think that we can provide not just all of our stakeholders, but more importantly, the legislature, more information, more detailed information. And that will likely show up in the major projects report as well. If I might address your question about the 2-year. So our funding, we really, even though our funding is on an annual basis for the biennium, we really have to manage our budget across the biennium. And let me give you a perfect example of why that is. So 3 years ago, we had a winter, a snow and ice season, that was in the mid to high 40s, million dollars, order of magnitude. The following year, we had what we thought then was the banner year. Turns out this is the banner year. and our snow and ice expenditures that following year was in the high $90 million, $98, $99 million. So that's a $50 million swing within one biennia between 2 years. So typically how we manage that is we have to withhold funding in the first year of the biennia to make sure we can get through the second year of the biennia. If we were to get into trouble, if you will, by overspending in the first year, we would have no reserves to be able to complete the snow and ice season. In addition, we always plan for spring flooding. And sometimes we have very little spring flooding, especially in the Red River Valley. And some years we have, you know, nearly catastrophic flooding. So those are some kind of contingencies, if you will, that we have to look at our budget and make sure we have enough to stretch for both of those. So the report you see there is the first year of the biennium. It represents fiscal year 13.
Okay.
So it's just 1 year of the biennium. Oh, excuse me, I think it's fiscal year 12. So it's 1 year of the biennium. If the report required, you know, biennial spending, I think it might be more useful to you because you could really do some greater analysis on that. I will also offer that we have, you know, kind of infinite ability to pull reports and do other data analysis. So,
careful what you promise.
So
he's learning.
So if that's not helpful, if you have other questions, we'd be happy to assist with that.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, this is not an affront to you, but I think our numbers person, Ms. Hatch, is maybe more appropriately able to answer this. But I've seen a lot of charts about our loss of purchasing power, and some of those are the inflation of road construction, the inflation of construction in general, and then compared to the I'm not sure which index it is. And I'm wondering, is there an index that we can look at that is a road construction index? And is that, you know, we've heard lane miles, we've heard all sorts of of things like that. What do you use, or is this anecdotal?
Nope. Mr. Chair, Senator, we actually have an economist on staff at MnDOT who does detailed analysis on our commodities that we purchase, and in the type of quantities we purchase them. So it's not even just a standard CPI index. We do track based on petroleum, for example, which is a significant driver for us, both in the fact that we purchase a lot of fuel. It takes fuel to get trucks down the road, for example. But also bituminous is largely petroleum-based and those kinds of commodities. So I'd be delighted to get back to you with more specifics about which indicators he does track, but he does really a full and detailed analysis annually, and then he benchmarks it throughout the year to evaluate how close we are and how far apart we are. We typically think about, although it's not, I hesitate to say it because it's not a hard and fast number, it does swing year to year, but we typically plan for about a 3% increase in inflation on the operating side of the business and on the capital side of the business of about 5% each year. Now, sometimes that's, you know, in fact, 2 years ago we had 12% inflation on the capital side. If you look total budget, total operating budget, we could easily lose anywhere from $80 to $100 million in purchasing power just on the operating side of the business alone, purely through inflation over a 10-year period. So we do track it. We do try to manage with it, but it is a significant impact to our operations as well as to the construction.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Howe and then Senator Champion.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And when you do that analysis and when you talk about the cost of petroleum, the cost of asphalt, is there times when you change the project to go to concrete? Rather than asphalt, just strictly because the commodities are too high, does that analysis go on? Do you change that project, or once you set a project in place, that's what you're going, and then you just adjust the prices and what you can do?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we so I'm on the finance end of the business, not the engineering end of the business that makes some of those decisions, but I know that they do factor in cost. They factor in a long-term look, so not just a short-term look. Sometimes products such as concrete are more expensive up front, but have a much longer life cycle. So I know that they do make those decisions. I couldn't tell you specifically that they would change a decision at the time of letting. They may. I'd have to have someone with more of an engineering background in project management get back to us on that question.
Because I would hope that,
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would hope that being on the finance end of that deal, that you would be at the table to make that decision at that time when that project's let. I would hope those discussions are going on.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we actually we have a committee that meets monthly called the Transportation Program Investment Committee, and I chair that committee. We don't necessarily discuss specific projects in there unless they're, you know, significant projects that could really swing a budget one way or another. But we would make a decision like that in that committee if it was a significant driver for us. I would suspect that on any one project, however, the cost alone would not be probably a significant enough driver to swing at our entire program. But I'd be happy to get back to you with some more information about how that process works. As I say, we have a STIP that's 4 years out. We actually try to plan about 10 years out, but we publish a STIP, the Statewide
STIP
Transportation Investment Plan.
Thank you.
And in that plan, projects are kind of queued up. And we have the closer it gets to the year of letting, we have a much more refined number, as well as all of the engineering that goes into that. But in terms of engineering decisions that might need to be made at different gates along the way, it wouldn't, at the last minute, be purely a financial decision. There may be other engineering factors that would have to get weighed. For example, if we made a major change, it could kick a project back to year five, and after the local agency or the constituents have been waiting to see their project come to fruition in that year of letting, if it was a smaller dollar amount compared to the entire project, we likely would not impact the user by making that happen.
And Mr. Chair, Representative,
Commissioner.
The whole idea of asphalt versus concrete is an issue we are certainly looking at, thinking about. It is actually a subject of an audit. So, you know, that is, and I like to say it's pure arithmetic, but it certainly goes to the heart of this life cycle cost as opposed to what's, you know, less expensive on day one. You have to kind of look at the entire you know, use of that asset, that road, and clearly concrete is the appropriate in many applications. For instance, major freight that might takes a larger, structure, but it is factored in, and there is actually some projects have alternatives for both to kind of see where pricing is on both. So that is a continuing interest for us to kind of refine.
So I have, I'll just give members the lineup here and just kind of draw your attention to the clock.
Yeah.
I have Senator Champion, then Senator Osmick, Representative O'Neill, Senator Jensen, then Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay.
So Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, my question revolves around both your articulation of the perfect storm looming, and I see what you have articulated there, and then I compare that to your focus or the three continued areas of focus or the continued areas of focus. And I see the concern around fiscal matters, which one should, and how materials are tied into that. But what I did not see and would like to ask your thoughts about is whether there's any concern or impact the change in demographics will have on MnDOT going forward. And if you believe that there is some concern around that, can you articulate for me what your plan is and your vision to address that issue if you do see it as a potential problem or risk?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, thank you for that question. Although we don't articulate it in terms of our capital forecast, the idea of actually managing a 5,000-person agency over another generation, we think about the future of our workforce, not just those out in the field, but engineers, truck drivers, central office staff, and knowing that the future workforce of this state is not going to look like the current workforce. As boomers retire, we have to take seriously how we recruit and to find not just more workers, but employees that reflect the population of the state. And I'm really thrilled that we've actually have kind of established a diversity and inclusion council within MnDOT to try to be thinking more proactively about what efforts we can make to build on the ones we've already been making for a number of years, some of our internship programs, some of our training programs, reaching out to different communities. We actually just went to a TASCA project work group that we are now part of as an agency with larger private sector employers that are dealing with the business case about future workforce and knowing that diversity and inclusion is actually central to that effort, not just the right thing to do. So it is on the top of our minds, and I know we think about this holistically. We know that there's more we can do. I think we've made some progress in the past year, so I appreciate the idea, and it does need to be. When we say that that enhancing our financial effectiveness is our main goal, it's not the only thing that we do. And frankly, I think in taking this 20-year look forces us to look at how we're going to deliver that with our own people and our contractors and our partners that go outside of just our employees. So it is an important consideration. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Senator Rosmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Zelli, on slide number 8, you start to touch on something that I think is of a priority for the next 20 years. It's efficiency. You talk about the performance-based design and give some examples. Can you quantify what type of savings to the taxpayer some of these projects, just as a guesstimate, some of these projects saved us as far as saving the taxpayer's money so we can make more efficient use of it, as well as what are you looking forward in the next 5, 10, 20 years to be able to more efficiently deliver transportation to the entire state of Minnesota, therefore being able to keep up with the actual increase in cost of the products?
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman and Senator, that's a great question, and I think we can look back. We can give you some, here's the actual budget savings on some of these projects, but some of the savings that I described go beyond just the MnDOT budget. It goes into taxpayer benefits in terms of reduced detours and increased mobility. We have at least made this commitment to put a stake in the ground that of the $12 billion gap over the next 20 years, that we need to be looking at the 15%, the $1.5 billion or so dollars that we should be able to generate through using performance-based design, innovation, and cost efficiency. But there's really two different numbers. I agree. There's the savings that we can generate through being smart about our investments. And second is the economic impact that we're preserving or saving. And I think that goes beyond that 15%. And we've just talked even this morning at our senior leadership team that we, in going forward, need to make maybe working with our economist to actually put some numbers behind that. And we don't have them now, although I think Deputy Commissioner Hatch might have some numbers on the actual cost savings of some of these projects, like the 494-169 alternative was a significant savings. But I think your point is some of the efficiencies I'm articulating are ones that go beyond our budget, but they do benefit our taxpayers. I saw an interesting article, profiling a truck driver recently in Star Tribune last week, and one of the questions was, Commissioner Zelli says we need more funding. Are you willing to pay a gas tax because the system is eroding? And his answer was really instructive, and it said, well, I don't think the system's changed a lot, and it's about the same condition as it was 15 years ago, but there seems to be a whole lot more traffic and a whole lot more use. And so, that's disturbing. Mm-hmm. But he says, but I think about my profit margin is so small. Can I really afford to have a gas tax increase? What would that mean? And it made me think about this because we have to be pretty clear about over the next 15 years, without additional investment, the cost to a truck driver of wear and tear from the potholes, the cost of actually waiting in traffic, the cost of actually not being able to deliver products and services has a significant cost. We ought to do a better job at sometimes quantifying
what the choices are for the state of Minnesota.
So, Commissioner, I know maybe you mentioned it in your presentation, and I just don't recall or I missed it. But there were some numbers put to the savings to the external savings when the Hastings Bridge was built by keeping the old bridge open during that entire time, which of course was extremely interesting to Red Wing because downtown is right there on the riverbank, and the detour would have been 60 some or 30, I don't remember how many miles. It would have been a pretty significant impact external to MnDOT, but you know, realized by that community and individual workers, drivers, and businesses. What was that number?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was 47 miles.
47 miles.
Detour.
And was there a metric put to the dollars saved to the
Mr.
overall
Chair,
economy or individual
we might
family
have,
pocketbooks?
I don't have the actual numbers of what we might have forecasted in terms of savings for the 47 miles. And it would be, you know, a judgment call as to what that number is. I know you're right. I think it would not be just closing a bridge. It would be closing Hastings, you know. So that would have
to say Red Wing. I meant Hastings. Sorry. great. To this point, because we're on a list here. Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Zelli, I'll just chime in on that in terms of what you did with the Hastings Bridge is similar to what your organization did with the Maryland Avenue Bridge, which is essentially the only way in off the east side unless you go over to 94 or 7th Street, same thing, or down to 36 or Arlington, almost the same thing. If you quantified just the lack of aggravation from my constituents of keeping that bridge open 6 months longer rather than shutting it down for 9 months while you built it in place, it was well worth whatever extra, if it did cost you extra, but I was told that it cost less to do it that way. So it's very, very important. If you can build those bridges off-site and move them over, that's a huge value to the community.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mahoney. You know, I do have two interesting numbers on that bridge. One is that there's 140,000 vehicles traveling through that corridor every day that would have been stopped. And they would be calling you. And quite an extraordinary feat when you see engineering and pretty good financial metrics kind of coming together. This was the first time that a 1,300 tons was actually moved by these big wheel movers very slowly and carefully. The other factor that is more than just convenience or lack of cost of disruption was the safety savings, because construction zone safety is something we've been talking here in the past week. By not having that be a construction zone, actually we don't know how many lives or damage to property we might have saved by not doing that.
Great, thanks. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Zelli. I'm glad you're here today, and thank you for all the work that you've done specifically up in my district. I appreciate that on I-94. I have a couple questions about life cycle costs that you had alluded to. And can you just maybe elaborate a little bit on that as to what was your prior sort of the weight of that decision of life cycle costs? So, like, if you put down an overlay and it lasts for 7 years and you have to go back and do it again, plus pothole repair in 7 years versus, say, a 20-year overlay or a 30-year overlay or even more, a 40-year overlay. And is that a factor that you are now considering? I guess I was unclear in your testimony previously. Was that something that you've always been considering, or is that something new that you're considering in how you decide if you're going to do a 7-year overlay or a 20-year overlay or a 30-year overlay or so on, depending if you're using – I guess it doesn't really matter if you're using asphalt or concrete, either that they have different properties. But if you could just speak to that. And then my other question is about innovation. So first, if you could elaborate a little bit about life cycle costs, and second is about some new innovation, and I'm also aware of sort of some testing with microwave technology in pothole repair, and I've actually witnessed that happening, and it was quite It was quite amazing what they can do, where they literally heat up the road surface, even as cold as it is in our winters, so that it almost melts it, so to speak, and then melt, and it just congeals everything together, so it becomes one smooth road surface again. Is that something that you are also actively considering, or where is that in the process?
Commissioner, lifecycle and innovation.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, well, thank you. The question about life cycle cost, this is something that MnDOT has been thinking about and working on. I think we have a renewed effort to try to measure the benefit and to even find better dashboards about what the remaining useful life is on a road. We have a wonderful dashboard which talks about pavement quality. We have focus groups that actually ride around in a vehicle and rate how the ride was. We measure the road with laser beams, and there's probably a lot of other things I don't know about. But the reality is, if you think about the life cycle cost of a road, and I've always kind of used the example of a bus, that a bus lasts about 12 to 15 years. It operates about 1.5 miles. Somewhere around 7 or 8 years, you have to rebuild the bus, replace the engine, and you get another great 5 or 6 years, whereas otherwise that bus would just be done. You'd have to buy a new bus. Well, for $600,000, I personally have spent, you know, money refurbishing a bus, but you have to do it at the right time. To take a 10-year-old bus that's kind of falling apart, would I really put $100,000 into a bus that's worth $30,000? You wouldn't. And a road and a bridge are exactly the same thing. There's a point when it's the smart time to do refurbishment. And we have through better roads and investments in pavement, we put in overlays. But remember, an overlay is not going to last. It gives that good ride. It helps the dashboard go up in terms of the number of roads that have good pavement in our state. Knowing that you have to go back 3 or 4 or 5 years later, you realize, wait a minute, that wasn't a good, and we didn't get much for that investment. And the problem is, of course, it's not just the money. It takes a long time to dig up and rebuild a road. So I think what has happened is, because of the scarcity of funding, MnDOT has not had a choice. We do not have enough funding in order to properly refurbish the roads at the best time. And there are some roads that have kind of tipped past the point where, frankly, it is not a good investment to put a refurbishment or an overlay. And it's frustrating, for many taxpayers to look at a road and say, oh, my God, why are you doing that road when this other one is in much worse shape? And if we're really being honest, we're saying that much worse shape road, it's beyond repair. That makes financial sense. So I think the idea of quantifying, getting transparency, so everybody kind of look and say, here's the useful life. Here's where the return is on this particular investment, whether it's new refurbishment or a thin. So it's a bit of a science, and I think we would like to get more transparency and arithmetic so taxpayers know here's where the money's going and here's how it could save funds over time to do it right.
Did I miss it? Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I would just add that you get to a point where you can't do an overlay anymore. You have to tear the road apart and fix the substructure. The structure of the road, the bed of the road that goes down farther, and even things like drainage structures, things like that the traveling public doesn't see, but really impacts the ability to provide longevity to that road surface. You get beyond the point of doing an overlay. You can't do anything but reconstruct the road. And so what we're trying to do is get to like the full life cycle cost. We right now our budget it's appropriated to us as capital and as operations and maintenance. And so on the capital side, there's certain things we can do with the money on the capital side. Operations and maintenance, there are certain things we can do on operations and maintenance side. And we really would like to work with the legislator to figure out what the right mix of flexibility might be with those funds. So when we get to the right place where right now we might only do a maintenance fix because the capital dollars aren't there or vice versa, that we can actually look at the total life cycle cost and manage the asset in that context.
Mr. Chair, and just one final point on your question about asphalt. We do have in Roseville a materials lab, and we are looking at what we can do in the winter filling in a cold pack that you have to redo in the spring doesn't seem like good investment. If we can do it right in the winter, we're looking at different materials to do that. So that's, you know, that's in our future, absolutely.
And Representative O'Neill, have you had a chance to tour the road research facility between here and St. Cloud?
No, but it is right between my district and Representative Fitzsimmons' district, and I believe that's on my calendar coming up, actually.
Great. We're going to do that, Mr. Chairman, in our committee next week or 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting.
I had actually requested that about a year ago.
So. Oh, good.
Well,
I've been up there twice. So.
We've actually just signed a memorandum to share information with Northern European countries. Not just other states. Mm-hmm. We can learn from Finland and others about asphalt and cold weather.
Okay, members, we do have to move things along. I have Senator Jensen on the list and Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I really like when you're talking about the transparency, like you just talked about. I'm curious, though, about the analysis of some of the data that you get. We hear a lot about different projects, different areas of the state, and as legislators, we have to think about the whole state. In my district in particular, we have construction costs that are 30% higher than other areas of the state. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that. And then we also have a lot of projects that get one bid. Is there anything within the department, a vision, a plan, or to kind of take on and tackle those particular kind of issues that come out of the transparent data that we get?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd be happy to answer that. We actually have the state, in fact, the Department of Administration essentially manages the procurement rules for the state, and we have some delegated authority up to certain levels because of the work that we do. So we take very seriously the process, and we do follow the process. We don't have the ability to it would be inappropriate for us to recruit, for example, companies to bid on projects, but we do try to cast the net wide, if you will, to make sure the information is out there. It's posted in the register and in other places to make sure that folks are aware of the ability to bid on those projects. We are aware of some areas of the state where we get very few bids and in some cases only one bid. We are looking at what options might be, but I given the procurement rules, it's not defined yet what our authority would be on that, other than to make sure we're communicating broadly. We're encouraging fair and competitive bidding. The other question you had, I was going to mention too.
The increased cost of construction.
Yes, increased cost of construction. I'm not aware of factors that would lead to higher cost in some states or some areas of the state versus others.
Okay.
It could be a factor of having less competitive bidding. Certainly would be a factor, and we'd be happy to look into that on a more kind of district-by-district or county-by-county basis. But one of the things I do know is that some locations in this state on the operations side of the business, if you will, when it comes to things like salt, pay significantly more per ton of salt, up to 3 or 4 times more per ton of salt in some areas of the state versus other areas of the state. And a lot of that has to do with the transportation cost for the companies that deliver the salt to us. So,
okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer for the final question.
Wow, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Zelli, great to see you again. And I want to say also thank you for funding the I-94 Corridors of Commerce Program. Good use of those dollars. Very good cost-effective area to use that in. So I appreciate that very much. As far as the Minnesota Road Research, congratulations on that contract and good work there. And the $1.5 billion in efficiencies, again, good leadership and appreciate that. I just have one quick question for you, and that is, as I read the risk contributing here to the more fuel-efficient vehicles, it brings me to mind that increasingly we have other kinds of fuel-efficient that use electric, natural gas. I'm sure there's things out there yet, maybe solar, a whole variety of things out there. And we appreciate your insight in regards to if there is less revenue, loss of purchasing power, those vehicles are increasingly also making use of roads. So how do you see making sure that we look forward in the future here and include them in that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you so much for you and interest and comments about I-94. We're very proud of the Corridors of Commerce projects, and this summer we're going to be starting quite a few of them, including that one. In terms of our overall funding, You know, it's interesting. Although vehicle miles is projected to be fairly flat, maybe up, maybe 1% over a period of years, the actual sources of funding will go down because of fuel efficiency, including electric cars. But gas tax is not the only source of funding now. Motor vehicle sales tax and registration fees continue to be sources of funding, and as we see cost of commodities increase, the traditional fixed gas tax is becoming smaller. We know, and we are part of a association of states looking at a mileage-based user program. I don't think this is something that the voters are ready for yet, but I do think we need to be part of every kind of study and work groups to know that eventually, and maybe eventually is certainly sooner than 20 years, we will actually have user fees associated with all vehicles, including electric and others. Right now, electric vehicles, because they are more expensive than their combustion engine counterparts, are actually paying more into the trunk highway fund because the motor vehicle sales tax actually funds a greater amount. So the Chevy Volt that I'm driving actually pays more to the highway trust fund because of the higher vehicle sales tax. So that eventually over time is probably going to come down, but I think it's just an area we should always continue to look at.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, members, let's move on. Thank you, Commissioner and Deputy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We have Eric Sundquist, State Smart Transportation Initiative, ready to share some thoughts with us.
Yep.
Welcome. Please identify yourself.
Yeah. Thank you to both of the chairs and the members of the committee. I'm really pleased to be here today and to give you a few remarks. First, let me describe what the State Smart Transportation Initiative is, and there's no way around it. It is headquartered at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. If it helps, my daughter is has an application pending here at the University of Minnesota, and I hope that you guys can keep that tuition reciprocity going for at least 4 or 5 more years. I hope it doesn't take longer than that.
It's our spot.
At any rate, just down the road, we are formerly part of a research center at the University of Wisconsin, but really a network of change-oriented DOT CEOs. So we convene about 20 CEOs once or twice a year to share best practices, policy initiatives, what have you, in a sort of a free-range conversation seeded by us but really driven by them. We also provide technical assistance to some of those DOTs, and we do outreach to the general transportation community in terms of webinars and newsletters and that sort of thing. So that's who we are. And as such, I am not here today as your utmost expert on MnDOT, but as somebody who works with innovative DOTs, including MnDOT around the country. I should say that the views I'm expressing are my own, and I don't have anything really to give you on the revenue issue and the revenue package, but only something that puts MnDOT in perspective in the greater context of the nation. So with that, one thing to frame that up, all state DOTs find themselves right now in a time of change. They're moving away from the great, epic, heroic highway building era of the 60s, 70s, and 80s to a time when their real focus is owning and operating and preserving their systems and working with stakeholders around other modes. It's a whole different deal, and every DOT is wrestling with that. That's pretty much, in a nutshell, our big effort is to make that paradigm shift and figure it out. Because throughout U.S. history, we've had other times of booms and busts in modes. If you think about the canal era, the railroad era, transit era, all of those had great growth and capitalization, and then they gave way to crisis and disinvestment. And so you're beginning to see what could be that crisis in roadway and highways right now. This is just a microcosm of it, the sort of critical split between revenues and needs in highways is one aspect of it. But just like, again, the whole idea of operating the system instead of just building, all of the other modes came around after a period of crisis and lots of expense at the taxpayer. Railroads went bust in the 70s. We bailed them out, and we still running Amtrak, but all the freight rail came out the other end. You know, transit went bust, and now the Green Line is coming along, and it's great. But we just we're hope we can manage the highway system in a way that we don't have to go to that extent. We kind of think of it as like IBM and the famous example of IBM. Here's a company that was making mainframes and typewriters, and everything shifted, and now they make software. Still in sort of the same business, and they're still making money. Think about some of a number of other competitors that just went by the wayside. I don't think Smith Corona exists anymore. So getting through this time of transition is really what we're looking at. And all of that involves thinking about providing transportation services, not just delivering projects, working with other providers, both public and private, providing greater mode choice, and more thoughtful work on transportation and land use. Because the best trip that you can have is one that you don't have to take. That's the cheapest one. If you can solve your problem by proximity, then the big costs of infrastructure sort of go down. So while all DOTs face some of these common challenges, however, it's difficult to compare DOT to DOT. And I used to think, before I got into this, I used to think that was just an excuse that they said that because they didn't really want people to know what was going on and they had something to hide. But the slide on the cost per lane mile, I think, is a good example. I can pretty much tell you why the order is the way it is. It's because the rural states per lane mile are cheaper to operate. You know, the cost of right-of-way, the cost of maintenance because of the lower traffic, picking up trash, lighting, signals, all of that stuff is less in a rural area. If you divide it instead of by lane miles by gross state product or per capita, it would be a whole different list. So if you want to make an urban state look good, you divide by gross state product. And so New Jersey and New York shoot up to the top of the list. You guys have a little of both, so you're going to end up probably in the middle of any of those lists. And what do you do with that? Probably, I'd say, not very much. So that means it's a lot harder to understand DOTs. And it's really heavily qualitative, requires a sort of a deep dive and understanding in their process and what their system is, what their challenges are, what their stakeholders are demanding. SSTI has done a number of these deep dives. We've been only around since 2010. We started with Pennsylvania. We've done Washington State, Massachusetts, and we just did California. We just delivered that last month to the Secretary of Transportation. And if you think that we're just here to puff up DOTs and be rah-rah, I think you go to that and read it. It was really quite critical, somewhat shockingly, to some of the stakeholders there who were happy about it, but shocked to see that the Secretary had kicked off this very critical look. And now we're working on them with implementation. It's going to be a very, very long slog at reform there. And I should say one thing that we discussed with the Secretary last week was a mission statement, starting with a mission statement. Their mission statement, despite one statewide policy initiative after another and a big change in what is expected out of transportation agencies, really hadn't changed since the 70s. And the one that MnDOT has is great, and that was the one that we showed to them. And we suggested that they pick that up nearly verbatim. I don't think they will, but that's my platonic ideal of holding out to them at this moment. So, because it's really about looking holistically about delivering people and goods to their destinations as opposed to building stuff or mobility or other abstractions. It's just really great, and it's something really good to build on, and I'll end with a thought about that in a minute. So we've had, throughout the four-year career of SSDI, we've had significant contact with MnDOT. Our inaugural meeting was here in the Twin Cities in 2010. Commissioner Sorrell attended it. Last year we had a workshop with a lower-level staff, or senior but not the CEOs, on active transportation, where MnDOT had representatives who had some very thoughtful things to say about performance measures. The very first meeting that we had a really impressive presentation from MnDOT on something they called the E-Jam, or electronic jam, where they really let 1,000 flowers bloom around the agency to see what was going right and going wrong and came up with some really thoughtful ideas for improvement. And you saw the other CEOs taking notes and actually building on that. We're also involved with FHWA in a thing that they call the Invest Tool. It's a benchmarking tool that compares your processes and organization against best practices around the country, again, in a qualitative way. It's a scoring system, but really it's qualitative at its heart. MnDOT was one of the first to take that up, and that takes some courage to hold yourself up against the best practices around the country. And they have taken that up. Again, this is several years ago, and written a report on what best practices, where they're falling short and where they could pick it up. So we're now, again, like with the California and the mission statement, we're working to get other DOTs to follow suit and do what MnDOT did, and we'd love to have a conversation with them about maybe doing another round of that because they've changed the tool, but that's probably too deep in the weeds. So we have a flagship document, and were it not for the fact that President's Day is an official UPS holiday, and so they didn't deliver them yesterday, you would have them at your table. You'll have them available probably tomorrow from Move Minnesota if you'd like to have one. I only have this one. But it's called the Innovative DOT. It's our effort to collect anecdotes and success stories from around the country on people moving the needle and really getting to a new, more efficient way of running things. And MnDOT appears in here in a number of places. So that's a pretty good sign. They were one of the ones that showed up quite a bit. We have 8 focus areas here. I'm going to very briefly just mention what they are and mention just a quick connection to MnDOT in each case, and then I'll be almost done. So the first one is revenues, and they do appear here in revenues in their mileage-based user fee work, which is, along with Oregon, the most far-reaching and far-thinking in the country. It does not only a way to perhaps raise revenues down the road, but also manage demand and be very cost-effective at the same time. Second item is revenue allocation and project selection. A lot of discussion here on asset management, and I know that I don't think I have to add very much, but I know that MnDOT was one of 3 states in a new FHWA pilot to really up their game in that in terms of data collection through LIDAR and all this kind of stuff, the data analysis, and then the decision rules, so you really do put your money where it makes the most sense. The national leaders in that right now are Michigan and Utah, but with this work in this pilot, I think MnDOT should be right up there with them very soon. Pricing is the third area in here. I mentioned MBOF, the miles-based user fees, also MinPass lanes and managing congestion that way, which everybody here is probably much more familiar with than I am in the particulars. The fourth is transportation system efficiency. Again, the commissioner talked to some of this and right-sizing projects and really trying to get managed toward performance and not just something that comes out of the book. And MnDOT has a long history of that with something called context-sensitive solutions. They were one of the leaders in the country on that, and it's sort of an antidote to that off-the-shelf. It's always got to have this wide of a lane or this many turning movements or what have you. The fifth one is options for mobility and access. The collaboration with transit in the Met Council area, including shoulder running buses, is an example that I'm aware of. I also am told that there's talk about updating the design standards that will not only move cars, but also be friendlier to bikes, pads, and transit. The sixth is freight. And when we got started with SSTI in 2010, the state rail plan had just come out in MnDOT. It was one of those exemplary documents around the country, and it was one that we wanted to share with other CEOs and did. Frankly, haven't followed it since then, but I know that it's an example of their work there. I don't know how well it's been implemented. The seventh is transportation and land use. Again, collaboration here in the Twin Cities with Met Council. And this is an area that if we were going to sit down with MnDOT, it's probably one we'd want to work on because of their really strong mission statement that implies proximity as well as mobility and solving problems, and that's a land use issue. And then finally, improving DOT processes. Sort of amorphous, but we have examples in here. My impression is, with this EJAM that I mentioned, that the staff and leadership at MnDOT really are striving to adapt and improve their processes. But one thing that all DOTs struggle with is how to tell the story. The best example of this around the country, and it's not even, I want to say it's not that good, but it's not perfect. Certainly room for improvement is Washington State, where they have a team that does what they call performance journalism. They publish something called the Gray Notebook. It's the exemplar around the country. They started about 10 years ago. I'm confident that if WSDOT wanted to grab that with the talent they had, they could take it to the next level and do Gray Notebook 2.0 and really tell the story probably better than cost per lane mile or whatever metric you want to come up with. There's new data sources coming online from the asset management LIDAR stuff to big data from Google and cell phone companies that show travel flows and let you match your services to the needs much better and also tell a story about what you're doing to meet the needs. So I guess I would just leave you with my educated impression of MnDOT as being very, very much forward as in terms of other state DOTs in their adaptation to the new realities that we face. With this really, I think this challenge, we're here to talk about accountability and transparency and so forth. I think that's something that everybody needs to work on, and that's something that probably as legislators and stakeholders, that would be something that you might want to work with the agency to look at. So I'll leave it at that, and if anybody has questions, I'd be glad to take them.
Thank you, Mr. Sundquist. Representative Hulbert kicks us off again.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I was able to go online and look at your report and a little bit of your website here, and I'm just curious. I wasn't able to identify the funding of your organization or Smart Growth America, which appears to be like a sister organization or involved in this report as well. Can you give us a little background on how these initiatives are funded?
Sure. So we had initial funding from a foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the federal government when we got started. That has now expired, and we have more second round of foundation funding from Rockefeller, but we sustain ourselves mostly now doing contracts. So the work that I described in California was on contract with the state. We have a contract in Massachusetts and with FHWA around this invest tool that I'm talking about. But so it's a combination of grants and contracts. The co-branding of the report is the only thing that we've really done formally with Smart Growth America. We happened to have a conversation about the need for this. We both had some resources, but not. We just pooled the resources to do this because each one couldn't really do it on their own. So that's all. It's not a sister organization, although we're friendly with them and sometimes run into them at the same conferences.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hulbert. Questions, members? So Mr. Sunkles, I'll just say you just email us the report, but I guess not. It's an inside joke.
It's not funny.
We had a little trouble with our email system in the Senate right now for five days now.
And we know you're not even providing a bed for your IT person who spends the night here. We just asked.
Okay. We'll get on that. All right. Anything else, members? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sundquist. Sorry, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you mentioned the new reality, what do you mean by that?
A mature, built-out interstate system, new demands for accountability in terms of building the economy, preserving natural resources, doing better with local communities where facilities go through so you're not imposing noise and other burdens on communities, community livability issues, the reemergence of transit and other modes as being more important than they were during the interstate building era. Those would be some of the main elements.
Mr. Chairman, I've heard the term used.
Representative Earhart.
Constrained design and constrained spending and constrained this and that, used by both our Metropolitan Council and the and MnDOT over the past year or two. And is that what you mean by new reality, that there are less money to be spent, and so therefore we shouldn't be building what we should be building, or what?
I wouldn't say we're not building what we should be building necessarily. It's just a fact of history that it's always easier to capitalize systems and build them in the first place than to operate and maintain them. And it's just not, you know, back in the 70s and 60s when people were cutting ribbons all the time, the money was flowing. Our economy wasn't richer, you know, but we were willing to devote more to that project than to the sort of less sexy system preservation needs that don't occasion ribbon cuttings and as much celebration. So, I drew the parallel to transit and some of the other modes. Transit was capitalized by developers in the early part of the century. They wanted to get people out to their development, so they buy houses. Once that was done, the capital dried up and the funding went away. It wasn't that the reason for transit changed that much, although it was competing with the car, and so there was that. So it's a long-winded answer, but I think the constraints on funding are sometimes artificial because we used to index gas taxes and now we don't in this country. We used to pass gas tax increases at the federal level pretty regularly and now we don't. I think if you start to back out and say, well, why is that? It was because people, a generation ago had a lot of enthusiasm for building interstates, and the task here is just not as, you're not rise to the level where people are willing to support it with the taxes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that instead of talking about constraint all the time, we've got the population of this country going on, growing larger. We had 1 million more people in Minnesota between the two 10-year intervals, and we have to think ahead out of constraining. We have to think about what we need to do and what it's going to cost, and then we have to figure out how to get the money to do what we need to be done. And so I don't like to hear constrain or new reality. The new reality is what we want to make it. Not sit around and wring our hands and say, we've got a bunch of people in charge of Washington that won't raise the gas tax or whatever else funding they need. Or we've got a bunch of people in the state that say, well, we really can't raise the money to correct some things that we need and build more and build out our transit system. I think that's a real defeatist attitude, and I was hoping you didn't mean that by your new reality.
Thanks. no need to respond. We need to move on. I didn't hear that myself, but yep. I agree with you, Representative Earhart. Members, we're going to bring forward George Garnett from the Summit Academy. He's down on the public testimony piece. He's got some students here who wanted to share some thoughts, and they have to leave in 5 minutes. So we're going to bring them forward and then get back to the Move Minnesota proposal.
Welcome, Mr. Chair. George Garnett.
Identify yourself for the record. Thank you, Mr.
Yes,
Garnett.
Summit Academy, OIC. We're at 935 Olson Memorial Highway in Minneapolis. We are located in Senator Champion's ward, and we appreciate his support of our work. What I would like to do very briefly today is talk about a different side of this equation, the side of opportunity and the people side of this. And I want to say, first of all, that we are a member of the Move Minnesota Coalition. We are supportive of the effort to struggle with and determine how to invest in transit and in roads and bridges so that we can expand opportunity for broad groups of people who historically have been outside of the workforce and outside of the economy throughout the state. And what I want to do now is introduce Mr. Guest, who is one of our students, and I would just like him to take a minute to introduce himself and talk a little bit about why he is in construction training with our school, and I'll talk a little bit more after he's done.
Welcome, Mr. Guest. Please identify yourself for the record.
Hi, I'm David Guest. I'm a student at Summit Academy. I'm a resident of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I currently enrolled in Summit Academy November the 18th, 2013. I'm currently in phase two of construction, carpentry. I currently work as a line cook at Green Mill Restaurant while I'm going to school. And the field is great. I'm looking forward to graduating in April and having a job in construction to help myself and my family. And I think I speak for all the students here at Summit that's with me when we say we would like to improve our lives.
All the students from Summit, can you raise your hands, please? Great. Thank you for being here. And when you leave, this room is going to feel empty. Yeah. We'll allow the applause because the house is in the room.
Well, thank you for that acknowledgement. This is our future workforce in this field. As all of you are aware, there are a number of trends that are impacting the workforce environment. We are seeing a historic number of people in the construction field leave the field, and that trend will continue at least through 2020. As you all know, it takes 4 to 5 years to train somebody to be a journey person in the field. And we are the beginning of that process with the young men and women who are here today. They are going to be the workforce of the future in highway heavy and in construction in this state for the next 30 to 40 years. We wanted them to have an opportunity to be here today. And I want to talk just a minute about the broader opportunities that transit represents, that transportation represents for our economy. My background is actually in community and economic development. I have struggled with the issues of transportation and transit throughout my professional life. Senator Hornstein and I spent some time at the Met Council a long time ago struggling with transit issues, struggling with the first light rail system in the Twin Cities. I spent a few years living in Duluth where I worked with low-income neighborhoods that as a part of their housing and planning work also had to think about how to get to places where jobs were, how to get to places where they needed to get groceries, such as the Central Hillside and the Lincoln Park neighborhoods. And throughout that work, it became clear to me, has become more and more clear to me, that transportation and transit is really about opportunity. And it's about the opportunity to be part of the economy, to participate in the economy, to obtain what you need to get from the economy, and to be able to contribute to the economy. We have broad pools of people who are frankly just isolated from the economy because of lack of access to transit and to transportation. We actually run buses to collect students from isolated parts of the East Metro to come to our campus in the West Metro because there is inadequate transportation to serve those students. The need for investment in transportation, transit, in bridges and roads. I happen to be on I-94 every day. I live on the east side of St. Paul. I work in Minneapolis, and I see those needs constantly. I just want to encourage you to struggle mightily with figuring out how to make investments in both roads, bridges, and transit, because we have large groups of our population that in the absence of those investments will not find opportunity and support for our economy. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Garnett, questions, members? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all the students for being here. I hope this isn't the last time we see you at the Capitol. This is your building, so we need you to participate. Okay, we'll revert back to item number two. I'll invite Margaret Donahoe and Barb Thelman forward.
Don't leave before doing this. just heard the budget.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the House and Senate Transportation Committees, I'm Barb Thoman. I'm the Executive Director of Transit for Livable Communities. I'm here with Margaret Donahoe, who's the Director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance, and we're here to talk with you about the Move Minnesota funding package in 2014. We have a very big coalition this year that has come together around the need for increased funding for all modes of transportation. The coalition stands now at about 150 organizations. It is broad and it's diverse. It includes 80 counties, 30 mayors, 15 cities, construction interests, public health interests, social justice interests, seniors, the disability community, the environmental community, 150 strong, all here to talk with you about the need to invest more in transportation in Minnesota. So we came together around a number of core principles. I'm going to have Margaret help me with that, sir. We have four core principles. And they are these. We want a package that's comprehensive. So we call it the three-legged stool of transportation, roads and bridges, public transit, and safe connections for bicycling and walking. We want a balanced package between modes, between parts of the metro, and between parts of Minnesota, greater Minnesota and the metro combined. We want sustainable funding. We want funding that's long-term, and funding that's going to grow with the economy to meet the needs of our state. And finally, we want funding that's dedicated. So funding that is dedicated to transportation so that we can continue to move, to improve and to maintain the system we have and the systems that we need. So we've talked a little bit today. You've heard a little bit about how things are changing. We need greater investment in transportation across the state to generate economic growth, to more conveniently move goods, services, and people to their destination, to provide equitable access to the jobs in our state, equitable access to housing and education, and for a very strong and good quality of life that we all enjoy. We also want to attract and retain talent to Minnesota, and I'll talk a little bit about that in my presentation later on. So that's a little bit of an overview of our coalition. I'm going to turn things over to Margaret, and she's going to start by talking about accountability.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I am the director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. I wanted to talk a little bit more about efficiency, accountability, transparency, as you've already heard some today. We really believe that the department has come a long way in providing more accountability and transparency in terms of how highway dollars are spent, at least. I know it was mentioned earlier, but I would highly recommend that you all take a look at this major highway projects report that was just completed in December. This report is the result of legislation that the Transportation Alliance and the Minnesota Chamber sought to get passed in 2012 that really does provide a wealth of information about how money is spent out of the Trunk Highway Fund, the results of some audits of some of MnDOT's management systems, and also some very, very specific information about highway projects. So for all of the major projects in the state, there's a one-pager that talks about the history of the project, the status of the project, if there have been any changes in the project, the engineer's cost, the bid letting cost. So you can really track what is happening with all of these projects all across the state. And we think this is exactly the kind of information that the public wants, that you all need in order to have oversight over how these dollars are being spent. Because what we hear from people all across the state, and I'm sure you hear it too, is people don't understand why their highway project is not getting done. So that's an important issue for people to understand the process, how difficult it is to fund every project with the amount of money that we have. It's just not doable. But this report at least shows how existing revenue is being spent and how it will be spent over the next 15 years. So, again, I think that's a really important advance that has been made. We also hear that it's important for more efficiency. So we can stretch dollars farther, we can get more projects done, and we absolutely agree with that. We want to see a package that includes both new revenue and some efficiency initiatives to advance more projects around the state. Some of the ideas that we have that I'll just throw out for consideration would save money that could then be reinvested in projects include exempting MnDOT from paying the state sales tax. Last session, local governments were exempted from paying the state sales tax. That did not include MnDOT. That's basically a shift of money from the Trunk Highway Fund to the general fund. More investment in right-of-way acquisition. Acquiring right-of-way for both highway and transit projects early on can save millions and millions of dollars in eventual project costs. When that land is not developed, that saves huge dollars in terms of projects. And we have a RALF fund, a right-of-way acquisition loan fund in the metro area that needs some more funding. That would be one way to make the system much more efficient. Federal and state fund swaps is another idea that has been considered. So we concentrate federal dollars on fewer projects because that reduces red tape that local governments have to go through when they receive federal dollars. Sometimes that can be very expensive. So that's another idea that we would suggest, along with some more streamlining when it comes to permitting, one-stop shopping for overweight truck permits, for example, is another way that we can save administrative costs. So we do think there are some ideas out there to improve efficiency, but at the end of the day, efficiency will not solve this problem. Even if we can achieve 15% of the need through efficiencies, we still have 85% of the need left. So it will take some additional revenue to really address this problem. So on the revenue side, one of the first things that we are recommending is to reallocate existing revenue that is going into the general fund that we think really the intent was to have this money dedicated to transportation. So back in 2008, when the last transportation funding package was passed, the legislature dedicated some of the sales tax on leased vehicles to both Greater Minnesota Transit and improving county highways in the metropolitan area. But we still have $32 million of that leased vehicle revenue going into the general fund. We think this is an important year. We have an opportunity with some additional funding in the general fund to fix that and close that loophole so that those dollars are going to transportation.
And Ms. Donahoe, that's 50% of the motor vehicle lease tax goes into transportation purposes, 50% goes into the general fund. Is that correct?
Actually, Mr. Chair, the way the legislation was originally set up had to do with a tax refund. So it sets aside the first $32 million that comes in.
Right.
It goes into the general fund, and whatever is left gets distributed between these two purposes.
Right.
And why was that decision made?
So sorry. I started it, and now we're going to get bogged down. Just very, very quickly, I think when the Constitution was amended to dedicate 100% of the motor vehicle sales tax to transportation purposes, there was an assumption that that also captured motor vehicle lease tax. Turns out that was a technicality that was missed and dropped, and so that didn't happen. But then when the 2008 bill was passed, at least part of that motor vehicle lease tax was captured for transportation purposes. And the other part, I think, was then kept in the general fund ostensibly. I mean, it's not directly earmarked, but the idea was that was going to fund the angel investor tax credit. It was just, the need for the resources was needed. There was also some pressure from the five county, the non-Hennepin, non-Ramsey counties for some money to go into their CASA system. Complicated
political situation that was resolved by this motor vehicle lease tax. And then some also went to Greater Minnesota Transit. So that's the very thumbnail history of this whole motor vehicle lease tax situation. Is that
yes.
accurate? Okay, thanks.
Okay, so moving on, the next piece that I wanted to talk about is actually an idea to reform the fuel tax in our state. And this is an idea that really is the cutting edge idea around the country and also at the federal level. Because everyone is facing the same problem, as you heard, that cars are becoming more fuel efficient. We have a revenue source that is dependent on consumption of fuel, but consumption is projected to decrease in the future. That means revenue will increase. We won't be able to take care of our roads and bridges the way we should. So what we're suggesting is something that the Senate members, I'm sure, remember from last session, is a gross receipts tax on fuel. It functions a lot like a sales tax, so that as the price of fuel increases, there would be a percentage of the price that would come in and be considered for the tax instead of just the per gallon tax. And we think this can be done very efficiently administratively. Unlike some of the discussion last session, the tax could be calculated, turned into a per gallon equivalent, and then the per gallon tax could be adjusted so that nothing would change in terms of how the tax is collected or who's exempt or any of the way the tax functions today. But going forward, then, we would have a system that would keep up with inflation, which the per gallon tax never will, and in fact will lose purchasing power very quickly as fuel consumption declines. So we think this is a way to make that revenue source much more sustainable in the future, and this is what a number of states, including Pennsylvania, Virginia, a number of states have moved to this kind of a system, recognizing the value of having something that tracks with the price of fuel versus consumption.
So now let's make a clarifying question.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been down this path before. I have a question on what you're suggesting here. You're saying that on a $3, let's say that the average price is $3 for a wholesale price, you're saying that you're going to impose a 15-cent a gallon, basically a 15-cent a gallon tax upon the public. Is that saying that you're going to be removing then the per gallon tax as a offset to that? Is that what the suggestion is, or is this in addition to the existing gas tax as we see it right now?
Well, our proposal would be to have this in addition to the existing tax, as it would basically adjust the existing tax once a year. And the amount, we're assuming, will be up for debate. But we know that last session, the Senate did consider a proposal that also reduced the per gallon tax by 6 cents a gallon. So depending on where that all shakes out, it could be a little less than that in terms of the actual increase amount.
One additional follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Another.
I guess I'm curious why we need to impose a brand new wholesale tax as opposed to just increase the gas tax by 15 cents. Because ultimately, and we spent many hours here, and I believe myself asked for 30 minutes, why we have to go in this direction, because ultimately the distributors are going to pass this along to the customers. And I think you will have to agree that this 15 cent a gallon under my scenario is going to be passed along to the customer, whether that's a residential customer, whether that is a trucker, whether it doesn't matter who it is. We're adding 15 cents to their taxes at the pump.
Mr. Chair, the reason that we are suggesting this is because, again, any amount of increase in the per gallon tax will be eroded by inflation and will be further eroded by a reduction in consumption in the future. This puts in place a system that will be adjusted annually, that doesn't require the legislature to necessarily raise the tax rate, just like the sales tax. Once you set that rate, if prices increase, the revenue increases without any change in the rate of the tax. And frankly, in Minnesota, we went 20 years with no increase in the rate of the gas tax. So that's why we're suggesting this system, and the fact that it's tied to the wholesale price of fuel does make sense in terms of construction, because construction costs are largely driven by the price of fuel. And as those prices for construction increase, they increase much higher than the consumer price index. So we think this is a better way to allow the state to keep up with those rising construction costs.
Thanks. Continue.
So again, I just want to follow up on what you've heard a lot about in terms of the needs that are out there. And so another part of what we're proposing is that an increase in the fuel tax would also allow the state to leverage more trunk highway bonds, which, as you've heard right now, the state is pretty much up against that 20% limit of spending money out of the trunk highway fund on debt service. So we're really not in a position to issue any more trunk highway bonds unless there's more revenue. With this proposal, we believe the state could easily leverage another $250 million per year in trunk highway bonds. That's $1 billion over 4 years. That would really make a dent in addressing some of the projects. And you see on this map, a lot of the projects that were submitted for funding for the Corridors of Commerce program, but with only $300 million available, only a few of those projects were actually able to be funded. So all of those projects are still out there waiting to be funded. And then finally, just to remind everybody, a lot of what you heard is that we do have an aging transportation system. And we're at the point where a lot of roads and bridges really need to be redone, reconstructed, replaced, not just repaired, not just an overlay. They get to a point where that really doesn't work anymore. They really do need to be reconstructed. And that's another reason why the existing revenue sources that we have at the existing rates are not able to keep up with the needs.
Thanks.
So back to me. I'm going to talk briefly about the new revenue to expand public transit in the seven county metro area and to ensure safer connections by bicycling and walking. And I'm also going to talk about funding for greater Minnesota communities to make those important bike and walk connections. So the Move Minnesota package proposes an increase in the regional sales tax of 0.75 cents. So that would put our regional sales tax for transit up to a full penny. That would raise about $340 million annually in new funding in the metro region. So why a sales tax? Why a regional sales tax for transit? Well, it is the funding source of choice for nearly all of our peer regions. Increasing our regional sales tax to a penny for transit and for a bike walk set aside would put us in an equivalent amount of most of our peer regions. There's a slide, I think, right here. It's also in your packet. Dallas, Denver, Atlanta, Cleveland, Houston, all of those regions dedicate a full 1 cent to public transit. Seattle dedicates 1.8 cents of a regional sales tax to public transit. So raising the sales tax at this rate would not put our regional sales tax overall significantly higher. It would be actually still somewhat lower than the regional sales taxes in our peer regions. So we also propose that of this new funding, there be a 10% set aside for bicycling and walking projects. That would be about $30 million a year to make those missing connections, sidewalks, trails, pedestrian ramps, access for people who are too young to drive, who are too old to drive, who are making trips on foot, who are making trips in a wheelchair. So allocation of that pot of money would be competitive, and we would see it those decisions being made by the GEARS Committee of the County's Transit Improvement Board. So you might be asking, well, last year the governor recommended a half cent, and so why are we proposing, and the Senate approved a half cent, why are we proposing 0.75 cents? Well, a half cent does not enable a large and broad enough expansion of bus service throughout the region. If you went to those meetings that Commissioner Zelli and Chair Haig had about transportation, you heard time and time again in communities across the region, we just want another bus on the weekend. We want a bus midday. We want to be able to come home from work at 7 o'clock at night, but the last bus leaves at 6. Those are the kind of investments that we think need to be included in this package. The governor's proposal included a 1% increase in bus service, and we're proposing that it be 4%. The governor's proposal also did not include the bike and walk connections, and so that's the reason that we're proposing a higher sales tax rate than did the governor last session. So what would this new funding enable in the region? It would allow, over the next 15 years, I'm going to go back one, there we go, for the region to build the system that has been on the Met Council drawing board for almost 20 years. It would enable 3 additional light rail lines, an East Metro project, the Botno line to Brooklyn Park, the Southwest line to Eden Prairie, more highway BRT, probably 5 of those, 12 arterial rapid bus like the one that's being proposed for Snelling Avenue up through Rosedale and onto Arden Hills, and this 4% increase in general bus service. As has been the case with Central Corridor, building out the transit system will provide jobs all across the state and make it easier to move goods and services through the metro. Transit is essential for people who can't afford a car. It's essential for students, and it's essential for people who do not drive. The bike walk set aside, the 10% set aside, would fund sidewalks, trails, pedestrian overpasses. A pedestrian overpass over an interstate can cost $1 to $2 million, each individual ones. And while the interstate is a wonderful connector between our communities, it also proposes a barrier for people who are trying to get across those on foot, to get to school, to get to work, to get to wherever they need to go. So these bike and walk connections make it safer and healthier for people to get to transit, to get to school, to get to the place that they work. And for lower-income residents who do not drive, it's an absolutely essential form of transportation. And you might also know that 12% of the traffic fatalities in Minnesota last year were people walking or people bicycling. So Margaret talked about the funding source for transit expansion in greater Minnesota, but we are in... for transit expansion in greater Minnesota, but we don't have and we need a source of funding to expand biking and walking in greater Minnesota. So our proposal to meet that need is an allocation of $16 million in federal surface transportation program funds, which is federal money for greater Minnesota bike ped needs. That's about $16 million a year. And again, the reasons are the same in greater Minnesota as they are in the metro. It's about access. It's about economic development. It's about vibrant small towns. I'm traveling next week up to Battle Lake. There is a meeting up there. I'm sorry, I'm going to Parker's Prairie. I'm getting my cities confused this week. Where there is a community meeting about how to make the MnDOT Main Street that passes through their town easier for people to cross and to improve the economic vitality of their downtown. So why does this make sense? Why does this make sense now? Well, for over a decade, you've been hearing us talk about peer regions and how we measure up or how we have fallen behind. There was the early leadership of Portland, Oregon on light rail and compact development. We talked with you about that probably 15 years ago now. And then for a long time, we talked about Denver and how they are building out a massive transit system of rail and bus, and that was an initiative that was strongly supported by the business community in the Denver metropolitan region. Salt Lake City looked at Denver, and they did almost the same thing. And now it's Seattle, with its focused growth plan focused on 20 regional centers of jobs and housing and 7 regional manufacturing centers. The Seattle region is investing nearly $1.5 billion annually to build and operate public transit. Amazon is paying to beef up the streetcar service that's connecting their new downtown campus with the light rail and bus hub and the bus tunnel that are in downtown. Amazon has 12,000 new downtown employees, 3/4 of which are expected to walk, bike, or take transit to work. I learned about this from a young man named Jed Hoffman, who grew up in Winona, Minnesota, and moved to Seattle to go to school, and he stayed and got a job there. And he said, I can live in Seattle, and I really barely need a car. So the Washington has big plans, and it isn't just public transportation. The Washington DOT is spending $3 billion to put their above-ground, elevated highway in a tunnel. So if we think our competition is only within the United States, we should look north, and we should look west, to Edmonton, to Calgary, and Vancouver, who have ambitious transit plans that rival Seattle. With our location in the middle of the country, in a cold place that many people don't appreciate the way we do, we can't afford to be complacent or to rest on our laurels. We can't just hope for the best and wait yet another year to put transportation on a stronger footing. Expanded transit makes this region a more attractive place to live, to work, to go to school, and even to retire. Increased demand for transit is where demographics and the market are headed, where young people want, but it's what young people want and what older people will need. The Itasca return on investment study showed that return on investment for a Twin Cities transit build-out was a 3-to-1 ratio. Transit makes it possible for workers to access jobs and for employers to reduce the very high cost of parking for customers and employees. So I think we can trust our state and we can trust our region to spend transit money and our road money wisely. Transit providers in Minnesota have been good stewards of the dollars they've been given. Duluth Transit, St. Cloud Transit, Metro Transit, and the suburban providers have all received prestigious national awards for the quality of their service. We are innovators. We are early adopters of green technologies. We were early adopters of IT. We have very low fare box. We have very low subsidy rates for public transit. We have high fare box recovery rates, and we provide a very good service at a low cost when compared to our peers. The problem is our systems are just too small. Thank you.
Great.
And I just wanted to conclude with a couple closing thoughts. We do think, as Barb said, that it is really urgent for the legislature to take action on this issue. Waiting year after year simply increases the costs for all of the projects, whether they're highway projects or transit projects. We know, as you heard at the previous hearing, how dire the situation is at the federal level. We really probably can't rely on Congress to help us out here and may be looking at cuts in the future to federal funding. So a number of states are stepping up and increasing funding at the state level. In 2013, there were half a dozen states who increased their fuel taxes, increased other taxes to pay for transportation. Around the country, there were many ballot initiatives dealing with transportation. And over 70% of the ballot initiatives, many of which either extended or increased a tax for transportation projects, were passed by voters. So voters support transportation funding, especially when they know the projects that will be built with that funding. There were gubernatorial candidates who ran on the fact that they passed transportation funding packages that included tax increases. That was their reelection campaign. This is something the public does want to see done. Our organizations represent tens of thousands of Minnesotans all across the state who want a safer and better transportation system. And as the commissioner mentioned, we tried to put together some comparisons of, you know, what we're talking about in terms of cost to drivers. The equivalent of a 10-cent increase in the gas tax would cost the average driver less than $2 a week versus the cost of being stuck in congestion or the cost of auto repair, which is significantly higher. Or, as was mentioned, the cost of owning a car, which can be $9,000 a year. Those are very real costs for families that happen when we don't take care of our transportation system. So we think this is a modest proposal that's based on user fees that the public supports that will get the projects done that the public wants to see done. So we appreciate your attention and would be happy to take any questions.
Questions, members? Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I completely agree with the premise that we're failing on basic road and bridge maintenance repair. We're failing on building a regional transit system. It's costing us, from an economically competitive perspective, all of those, being incredibly underserved and having it drive that demographic that we need to other cities, Denver and others. I'd like to just focus on the one principle, one of your four principles, which is balanced. And I assume by that you mean fair to everybody, and that would include both the taxing and spending level. So one is a clarifying question about your slide that says allocate existing flexible federal funding. Is that the total amount of flexible federal funding, $16
million? Okay. No, the Minnesota receives about $650 million a year in federal funding. So one of the pots of funding, which is a little over $200 million, is called Surface Transportation Program. And so this would be a small set-aside within the Surface Transportation Program. And Metro Council allocates that money in the metro region, and MnDOT allocates the money through its area transportation partnerships in greater Minnesota.
And so currently none of it is going to the two items that you're specifying?
No, there's I'm forgetting my manners today. Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman. There is a federal program called Transportation Alternatives. It used to be called Transportation Enhancements. That's a very small amount of money that is available to be used for about a dozen different things, and bicycling and walking are one of those things. And that's about 2% of our state's federal funding.
And, Mr. Chair, the reason I call attention to that is I wanted to clarify because, I think this has been the sticking point, as you know, for many of us, because it looked as though we're taking federal money for a greater Minnesota problem, but then when you go to the increase and extend seven-county sales tax, that small group geographically is going to have another tax imposed on it to do its own work.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, so this surface transportation program funding is allocated in the metropolitan area through the Met Council by the Transportation Advisory Board. The surface transportation program money in the rest of the state is allocated by MnDOT and through the Area Transportation Partnership. So this is money that would have been going to greater Minnesota. We're not proposing that STP money from the Metro be spent in greater Minnesota.
So everyone in the state, Mr. Chair, will have a tax raised on them to pay for transit.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
In terms of the balanced, so you're saying this is, this slide about the seven-county metro area, they aren't the only ones who are having a tax imposed on them to get their transit paid for.
The sales tax that we are proposing as part of Move Minnesota, the 3/4 cent sales tax increase, is in the seven-county metropolitan area.
Yes. But, Ms. Stillman, I think Representative Hausman's asking, what about greater Minnesota transit? Is that
right.
Correct?
Okay. Mr.
Chair, we don't have a specific tax increase proposed for Greater Minnesota Transit. As you recall, last session, there was a change in the local option sales tax in Greater Minnesota, and some counties are starting to look at that for transit. Olmsted County, in particular, did pass or agree to impose a 1/4 cent local option sales tax for transit in Olmsted County, and we believe that more counties in greater Minnesota will start looking at that option to fund transit locally. And also, when we look at the local share for greater Minnesota transit, it is about 30% in reality. While the statute calls for a local match of either 15% or 20%, depending on the size of the system. So local transit systems are contributing local tax dollars to transit, and we think that will continue in the future.
And then just one final question, Mr. Chair, and that is, since we normally think now in terms of an 11-county or 13-county metropolitan area, why are we imposing it only on 7 counties?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, if you look at Metro Transit has done, actually the Metropolitan Council has done a really good job of looking at transit market service areas, I think they call them. They have they look at job density of jobs, density of housing, and then they look at what percentage of the population does not have access to a motor vehicle. And if you look way out into those 11 counties, certainly some people in those counties are commuting into work every day, but are most of those counties where you could have cost-effective transit service, local service? It would be very difficult. Even the transit market service areas don't even go all the way out to the edges of all 7 of the metro counties. We still have a significant amount of agricultural land within our 7 counties. So, I mean, I guess that's a discussion that you could have with the Metropolitan Council, but, you know, providing service way out into, you know, Wright County or Chisago County, unless it was just express service to a park and ride, would be extremely expensive. And I think they might tell you those would not be the best places to spend a public transit dollar.
All right, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I want to compliment Move Minnesota on bringing together a lot of people from across the state, from a lot of different interests, to talk about what I think is a critical infrastructure issue for the state. I also compliment you on the principles that from which you work. I want to shift a little bit to the talk about roads, and particularly about regional corridors and regional centers. Last week, we heard from a couple of representatives from the New Ulm business community about discouragement for actually 2 generations of waiting to be for improvement of road access to a trucking community and a manufacturing community in New Ulm. New Ulm being the largest town in Minnesota that doesn't have a 4-lane road. And when they spoke about funding, new funding for highways or new funding for transportation, they said, we felt left out, that we need to make sure that if we're going to support new funding for roads, we need to have a shot at that. Currently in the 20-year plan for MnDOT, they don't have a shot at it. Regional corridors were neglected in that plan, and history serves on explaining their situation. That's why I was glad to see your proposal for focusing on the funding for the corridors of commerce. And that, I would assume, would give hope, and I think would give hope, to my neighbors in New Ulm. I guess I would appreciate comments about it's not only New Ulm. How extensive is that, and what other communities how extensive is the need for this increased funding to improve interregional corridor transportation?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Donahoe.
Representative Johnson, that is an excellent question, and that is exactly our proposal, that we would devote a significant amount of revenue to the Corridors of Commerce program. We know that with the $300 million in bond proceeds that were authorized last session, there were over 100 projects submitted for funding worth billions of dollars in need that is out there. And as I think you saw on the map that we had, those projects are all over the states. And a lot of them are very familiar to all of you and to people all over Minnesota. Expanding Highway 23, as you mentioned, the folks from New Ulm think they're the only ones without a 4-lane highway. The people in Marshall think they're the only ones without a 4-lane highway. There are communities all over the state who have been waiting decades, and generations of people who've been waiting for some of these corridors to be improved. And it is absolutely critical to start to address these problems. It's much more cost-effective to address them when plans have been going on for decades and the land values are increasing, the costs are increasing all the time, and we know that freight movement will increase in the future. If we want to have a state that does more exporting, if we want to have a state that has more business, we have to have the transportation system that can handle heavier truckloads, that has bridges that can handle those loads. We have to have the kinds of projects that you see on this map are projects that are absolutely needed. It's not a wish list. But the reality is with $300 million in trunk highway bonds, the department was able to fund pieces of 10 projects out of over 100 projects that were submitted. So the need is there, and we think that this proposal, as I said, that can leverage additional trunk highway bonds will make a big dent in addressing the projects that you see in red on this map.
Follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Johnson. Mr. Chair. I also want to connect this with what Mr. Sundquist said about how when he was speculating about the impact of investments in the rural states, these would be more rural roads. They're freight heavy. I know that in Nicollet, where we've been working on a bypass and an interchange, there are 18% of the vehicles going through that intersection are trucks. And so, but he speculated that we would have the longer-term impact. They would be less expensive to maintain over time. So the investments that we would make in Marshall and Wilmer and in New Ulm could possibly have a longer-lasting effect. Did you see that connection at all? Or?
Mr. Chair.
And, just members, I just want to call your attention to the clock and the fact that we have some folks from the public who want to share some thoughts with us as well.
Yes, I guess I would just add that, you know, interest rates are still fairly low, and again, that does impact bonds, trunk highway bonds, and so doing these things sooner rather than later will definitely cost less in the long run.
Great. Thank you. Representative Mahoney, and give that little thingy.
Thank you, perfect. Mr. Chair, and I'm looking at this building out a regional transit system by 2030. And you mentioned four lines, Botno, Southwest, Hiawatha, and the Central line. Now, I'm just trying to figure out where the balance is in there, because everything I've heard over in the East Metro is arterial bus or buses. So is there a balance in there? Because that certainly doesn't seem balanced to an East Metro person. It just seems like leftovers to me.
If I did not say, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, if I did not say an East Metro light rail project, then I misspoke. The three projects that, Central will open in June. Hiawatha, the blue line, is already open. And the proposal is for an East Metro project, the Botno project to Brooklyn Park, and then the Southwest Light Rail out to Eden Prairie. Those are the three that would be contained within this concept plan within Move Minnesota, in addition to highway bus rapid transit, five of those that were on the map. Maybe, Margaret, you can help us get back to the map.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Jacob, I know that St. Paul is also looking at, there are 12 arterial rapid bus corridors, including one on Snelling Avenue. That's the one that is currently proposed to go up to Rosedale. And then on, people are saying, let's bring it further north up to Arden Hills. One of the other lines that scored very highly in the arterial rapid bus was the East 7th to West 7th line. So from the airport out to, I don't know actually how far out to the east it would go, and now people are saying, well, maybe that is the corridor that we want to have either be a streetcar or to be light rail, the old Riverview corridor. So I think there's tremendous interest in improving transit on the east side of the metro. I'm very encouraged that there is a new group that's beginning to meet about what are the transit investments that we need on the east side. There was just a very big public engagement process talking with people about what can we do soon in terms of additional bus service on the east side, things that won't be 5 years and 10 years off.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members and to the witnesses and to the public, kind of the statement that you made was in and of itself, it's all on the East Metro is buses, and all on the west side is commuter rail or light rail transit. And you had several of them that you mentioned, the East 7th Street, the Gateway Corridor, the 36. These are all buses. I don't know why, as an East Metro legislator, I should support your particular proposal, because all I feel like I'm getting is the leftover. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an afterthought. I get all the stuff that someplace else doesn't want. So at this particular point, and I'm not asking for an answer, I just want you to know the frustration of the East Metro legislators that always get buses and the other side of town gets the rail.
All right. Let's see. We have Senator Osbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Maybe for the final word.
Right. Ooh, I will try and make it as brief as possible. Right. I just want to put some things in context. So on your slide here that talks about the penny, so what your proposal would do, in effect, would jump us from one of the lower ones on the chain of sales taxes to number three. We would go from 7.75 to 8.5%, which puts us number three out of that list of cities. That's what your proposal does. Is that correct?
Sorry, I'm just trying to grab it here.
That jump us to 8.5, which would be one of the highest sales taxes.
It would be, Mr. Chair, and Senator Osmek, it would put us in the realm. It would put us with those cities that compete most closely with us. It would put us about the same as those particular regions.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, a couple of more follow-up questions. So, in your proposal to increase the metro sales tax by 300%, because that's what this is doing, it's going from a quarter to a full cent. It's a 300% increase. This would also be imposed upon Carver and Scott counties. I'm assuming Senator Pratt would be very interested in the fact that they're going to be going from zero to a 1 full percent point, because we would be enforcing this upon Carver and Scott County. Your number enforces that across those two jurisdictions who currently don't have that tax, correct?
Ms. Dolman.
Mr. Chair and Senator, currently the quarter cent regional sales tax is not imposed in Scott and Carver County. They did not vote to join the county's transit improvement board. We have heard that there is interest in being on the part of those counties to being a part of the regional transit system. I also think there is, and I'm not the expert on this, there is some difficulty in having a sales tax that is differentiated in terms of its size from county to county within the metro region. It's maybe, if Dave Van Hattem is here, he could talk a little bit about what he's heard about that. But in terms of the magnitude of this increase, yes, it's an increase from a quarter cent to a full penny, but that's what regions typically do. That's what our competitor regions have done over the last 15 years. When the sales tax in Seattle jumped up, it jumped up 4/10 of a cent at a time. In another region, it jumped up 0.5 cent at a time. And they have been incrementally increasing their sales tax, which we have not been doing. So this is about trying to catch up.
One additional follow-up.
Senator Osmond.
So for your, actually two, I'll make them very brief. For your 3/4 cent sales tax, that is exclusive to transit. That is not one lane of pavement. That's not one bridge in the metropolitan area. That's not one inch of concrete laid down on 494. That is for transit. That is not for cars and streets, correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the investments would be for rail, for bus, for construction of park and rides along metro freeways, for operation of all of those facilities, but not for construction or maintenance of roads. That's why we're here together. That's why we have two different funding sources.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Thelman, what would the resources be used for those elements of roadways that would benefit bicycle and pedestrian use?
The set-aside of the regional sales tax of 10% is for bicycle and pedestrian projects. I suppose that some of those could be a trail alongside a road, a sidewalk alongside a road.
That's not what he means.
Okay,
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final question. So you're indicating here $335 million annually would be raised by this three-quarter cent increase. Is that taking into account changes in spending habits of individuals, such as if I'm going to buy a $20,000 vehicle and I live on the western side of Hennepin County, I almost guarantee you I'm going to be going over to Representative O'Neill's lovely Buffalo and buying a vehicle in Buffalo because it will be $150 on just this tax increase less. That's money in consumers' pockets. Did you account for that and changes in spending habits that maybe it may actually occur as a result of this tax?
Well, Senator Osbeck, I don't know that the motor vehicle purchase is an accurate analogy because that's typically kept out of the general sales tax.
But in general, my statement holds true, Mr. Chair, that do you account for changes in habits of individuals who will avoid the tax, particularly on the outskirts of the metropolitan area?
Ms. Thelman.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator, so I think you're asking, will this increase in the tax in the overall rate within the seven-county metro area make the seven-county metro area less competitive vis-a-vis the rest of the 80 counties and reduce the amount of spending that people do in those seven counties? I think now we see, we have seen that the metro area's population and the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul's rate of population and economic activity have been growing considerably over the last 4 or 5 years, and we have a higher sales tax already. So I am I am not with the Department of Revenue, and I'm not a tax accountant, but anecdotally, it seems to me that this higher tax that we have already has not reduced the amount that people are spending within the seven-county metro area or within Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't see counsel here, but if I remember correctly, that option of joining the pool is now available to Carver and Scott if they choose to accept the rest of the burden.
That is correct, yeah. I'll act as counsel. great. Thank you. Thank you both. Senator Pratt.
Yeah, thank you. Looks like we lost our test fires, but I'll just go ahead certently there is interest in Carver and Scott, Representative Earhart. The problem is that the return just isn't there. We have no defined transit ways. We share the same problem that Dakota County does, and we have to get across the river. And certainly with the growth in Shakopee, moving people and the impending loss of the I-35 bridge is going to mean that we have to get very, very creative. It's interesting, though, as we talk about the areas that we are competing against, we're talking about areas that have been growing over the last 40, 50 years. 1960 to 2010, and where the population has been moving to more moderate climates than ours. And then you look at just income tax as an example, the areas of Denver and Austin, Colorado has a 4.6% flat tax on income. Texas has no income tax. Washington has no income tax. So certainly there needs to be tax reform and even prioritization. I certainly agree with a number of the statements made in investing in roads and bridges. The problem is prioritization and where we put our efforts.
Great. Thank you. All right. We're going to move to testimony. We have the list in order, as I'm going to call it, so folks have the agenda in their hand. Please look at that if you're on the list of folks who called ahead of time to testify. And we need to queue you up quickly and move through testimony with brevity as we can because the hour has grown late. Two, 3 minutes per testifier, please. And if someone's already said what you plan to say, please eliminate that part of your testimony. Dustin Loosbrook, John Schuler, and John Welly, please come forward. the committee, please identify yourself.
My name is Dustin Loosbrook. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Dustin Loosbrook. I live in Champlin. And for the last 10 years, I've been a heavy equipment operator. I'm a proud member of Local 49 Operating Engineers. And I have worked in many different industries within the infrastructure business, building roads, bridges, pipelines, various different things. But not only do I earn my living doing that, I was raised on those wages. My dad put food on the table and clothes on our backs with those jobs. And and this is difficult work and challenging work, but it's good-paying union jobs that provide a world-class healthcare system and a secure pension. And these are the qualities that jobs need to have to strengthen the middle class and to promote a strong Minnesota economy. It's been difficult to be a construction worker in the last 7 years. We've lost over 50,000 jobs since 2006 to 2012. And that's the worst across this nation. I know many operators and other skilled tradesmen who have either had to take non-construction jobs that pay far less with no benefits, or they've others who have had to leave their families and leave their homes and go in search of work, including myself. 8 years ago, I bought a home in Minnesota, and I had to choose between losing that home or going on the road. Since I've, for the last 7 years, I think last year alone, I lived in that house for about a year. That was the first full year I spent in my home. I was fortunate. I was fortunate enough to find work, but it was difficult. I traveled across this country from state to state and even found myself overseas for a short time doing some work over there. I miss births, birthdays, Christmases, Thanksgivings, funerals, weddings, but these are the sacrifices that I need to make. I always called Minnesota my home. When you work out of town, you don't get vacation time, you don't get personal days, you don't get weekends with your family. You're at the liberty of a project, and when that project's done, you're searching for the next one. Although my story may be unique in its details, that's the same story that many Minnesotans carry, you know, on a broader scale. A couple of years ago, we filled these halls, and I know some of you are here to fight for prevailing wage laws and to maintain those rights that we have in this state. And I'd just like to say I thank you all who supported us on that. I really do. That makes a huge difference, at least in my income and in my family's income. But the problem is that prevailing wage is an hourly rate. There's two aspects to that. We need the dollars per hour, but we also need the hours, because the last time I checked, anything times zero is zero. So I stand before you asking you to allocate the funding to create the work hours needed to put the hardworking tradesmen and women of Minnesota to work building the projects that will promote the overall economical growth of this state we proudly call home. Transportation and infrastructure are the most important factors in economical growth. As we've heard from the DOT and we've heard from the Transportation Alliance and everybody else, we've made this pretty clear. But it also puts food on the tables of the working men and women of our state, most of which who hope in a year to make far less than what the council members here make in this session. The thing about it is we've heard the systems do not have a shelf life. And every year we come down here, and it's like we're searching through our couch cushions trying to find money to fund the very thing that promotes the growth of our economy. It keeps every one of us employed, whether you be a senator here fighting for it or you're a business owner who's manufacturing something in this state. I'm going to conclude with this. I've worked in third world countries over the past few years. I worked in some states that could be considered third world countries, to be honest with you. And the one thing that I've noticed is the difference between a first world and a third world country in my experiences is that it's called an investment in the people. And an investment in Minnesota's transportation systems is an investment in the people of Minnesota. Transportation is going to have a direct effect on every Minnesotan's life. Mr. Chair, members, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Loosbrook. Mr. Schuler,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm John Schuller. I'm a Redwood County commissioner. That's about 2.5 hours southwest of here.
Thank you for making the trip to be with us today.
I appreciate being here. I'm also the AMC transportation chair, so I'm very happy to be here today to testify. To date, I should back up. AMC has identified transportation as their priority issue for this year. And that's through all the counties in the state of Minnesota. 78 counties have passed resolutions in support of the Move Minnesota initiative. I know what the political will. I know what it takes to look for funding and to raise revenue. 47 counties have passed the local option wheelage tax as of to date. I expect that number to grow. Just for the record, our county is not one of the 47, but we may in the future. The TFAC report lists a gap of $250 million per year in transportation funding. Investing in transportation is about economic growth. It is about our workforce. It does create jobs. I'm going to try to keep this brief. Redwood County is the second highest corn and soybean producer in the state. Just transporting goods, agricultural goods to Minnesota is a $31 billion industry. We have over 500,000 acres in production. One co-op alone handles over 35 million bushels. Our yields keep going up. The roads haven't changed since I've been in high school, which is quite a while ago. This is a list of our deficient bridges. We have 27 bridges on our list that we passed this year. That's over 10% of our bridges that are listed as deficient. This five-year plan, I know we're not going to do all of them, but that shows the need. That's not unique to Redwood County. That's a Minnesota thing. We got a lot of bridges out there that are deficient. This is our five-year highway plan. I've been an elected official since 1990 as a township officer as I started. This used to be full of roads being rebuilt, repaved, mill overlaid, sealing, bridges being replaced. If you look at 2016 and 17, there's nothing on here. Which is sad. So over 24 years, we failed to keep up the pace, the cost of material. When I started on the town board, gravel was probably $3 a yard. Now you can't even buy gravel $3 a yard, not to mention the transportation. You can't not keep up with funding for our infrastructure. It's just not sustainable. So with that, I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Welling from Aitkin County.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Dibble, Chairman Hornstein, committee members, for allowing me a few minutes to speak to you this afternoon in support of the Move Minnesota Transportation Funding Initiative. Now, I speak not only as the Aitkin County engineer, but also as representative and current vice president of the Minnesota County Engineers Association. Now, when our association was approached late last year to sign on as supporters of the Move Minnesota initiative, our members offered their complete support because we as county engineers see firsthand the challenges of trying to maintain and improve our highway systems with financial resources that year after year fail to keep pace with ever-increasing needs, ever-increasing demands, and ever-increasing costs. The highway systems in our counties are very different, some of them carrying very large volumes of people, others carrying very large volumes of freight, whether it's agricultural freight, forest products freight, or mining and manufacturing freight. And some roads carry both of those. But we all have one thing in common, and that is that we are falling farther and farther behind in our efforts to provide a safe and viable highway system for our citizens. Now, I want to take just a minute to talk about our situation in Aitkin County. And I do so because I believe that what's happening in Aitkin County is representative of what's happening in counties throughout greater Minnesota. But first, on the annual maintenance side, this year in 2014, we needed to increase our local property tax levy by 7% over the previous year to fund our annual roadway maintenance costs. Now, that was the second year out of three that we had to do a 7% increase. And while that may not sound like a big increase, in a county that strives year after year to maintain overall levy increases on the order of 0 or 1 or 2%, this is problematic in the overall budget. We're seeing these large increases in property tax levy dollars going to our highway maintenance funds or to our highway maintenance program despite our efforts to lower the cost of doing maintenance. We have stripped back our maintenance programs to essentially do bare bones, minimalistic type of maintenance approaches. We don't have the money to invest in maintenance that we'd like to do, maintenance that perhaps costs more money up front but would serve citizens better and result in lower costs long term. We just don't even have the option to do that because, as I said, we're strapped with money. The reason for the large increases in property tax levy going towards our annual highway routine maintenance is simply that the other primary funding source that we have, our state aid maintenance allotment that comes to us through the Highway Users Tax Distribution Fund, it has not kept pace. And when you have two primary funding sources and one isn't keeping pace, the other not only has to keep pace, but it needs to make up the difference. And that's exactly what's happened with our property tax situation. It's a little bit sad to say that every year since 1999, when I became county engineer in Aiken County, we have relied more and more on property tax levy to fund our annual highway maintenance program. So now on the construction side, as I sit here today in Aiken County, close to a third of our pavements are in poor condition. And this is a result of rising costs of bituminous asphalt over the past 10 years. Now, I don't want to throw a bunch of numbers out at you, but I do need to cite a couple numbers that I think prove the point. In 2004, in Aiken County, we paid less than $23 per ton for bituminous asphalt placed on our roadways. 10 years later, in 2014, we haven't opened up any bids, but our estimates are $60 per ton for bituminous asphalt material. Now, that's a 160% increase in cost in a 10-year time period. And if you look at what revenue has done during that same time period, again, our state aid construction revenue that comes to us through the Highway Users Distribution Fund, which is the primary funding source to do these type of projects in Aiken County and other counties around the state. I don't know what's happened in every county, but in Aiken County, that revenue has increased 30% in that same time frame. So it's pretty easy to see that when you're dealing with cost increases as significant as that and funding increases that are only on the order of 30%, we have a big problem. So we have over 80 miles of pavement, as I said, that are in poor condition today. And you would think that we would have plans to deal with those pavements, that we would be doing pavement work this coming year. We are not going to be doing any major work on a single one of those miles, and simply because we are out of money. We have advanced our state aid for a couple of years. We have used up our grants. We have spent down our balances, and we simply need a year to catch up and not spend any money. The sad part about when you delay a project like that on a road, on a paved road, is that long term you're actually costing the public more money when you eventually do get around to putting an improvement onto that roadway. You have a couple things working against you. Not only construction inflation that's going to cost more for the same project a few years down the road, but also, as any pavement engineer will tell you, when you fail to provide the adequate fix to a pavement at the right time in its life cycle, you are increasing the cost of future improvements because the pavement continues to deteriorate. You miss the point at which to do the most efficient fix, and you now are out in the future with a more expensive fix. So what is our plan in Aiken County to deal with this? This may sound a little odd, but for the next 4 months, our plan is hope, and that is simply hope that the 88th Minnesota Legislature, under the leadership of your committees, will take the bold step to enact significant transportation funding legislation. And I say that in all honesty because we have been trying for 2 years to implement a 5-year road improvement plan similar to the one in Redwood County. And we have not been able to do that simply because the money that we need and the money that's available are very far apart.
Okay, Mr. Welly, are you about ready to wrap up?
Okay.
Thanks.
So in closing, I guess I just want to urge support of the Move Minnesota initiative by enacting much-needed funding increases, and especially those, as we heard earlier, such as a sales tax on wholesale fuel that will provide long-term sustainable increases in transportation funding. The opportunity is here now. Minnesotans are eagerly waiting for you to take this bold action to ensure their safe and efficient travel throughout our state for years to come. Thank you.
Great. Very much appreciate your travel to be here with us and your thoughts as well. Thank you. Okay. I'll call up the next three folks. We have Aaron Daly, Jody Gertkin, and Kent Sewell. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair of the committee, my name is Aaron Daly, and I'm here today as a senior at McAllister College here in St. Paul, hoping to speak in favor of the Move MN proposal and a little bit more about what transit and transportation accessibility has meant to me as a student and someone who's about to graduate and would really like to contribute to a bustling economy such as the one we have here in the Twin Cities. Growing up in a rural area, when I came to St. Paul in 2010, I was blown away by the transit options suddenly available to me. McAllister is positioned on the 84 and 63 bus lines, and I thought from that intersection I could get anywhere in the world. sort of true. But thanks to those bus lines and the urban location of McAllister, I've been able to partake or be an intern at multiple organizations outside of the Twin Cities and take advantage of the employment resources and all the opportunities and quality of life that we have here that really have made my education more than just something I can do in a classroom, which has made my time at McAllister and in St. Paul absolutely fantastic. But moving forward, McAllister has an extremely diverse student body, and I hear from students all the time that they're not going to stick around the Twin Cities because they're coming from cities like Portland and New York or places in Korea and the Netherlands where transportation and access are so much more a priority and are so much more available to them. And I find it really frustrating as someone who's fallen in love with the Twin Cities that they can't see the hope that I can in hearing these murmurings of a more sustainable, more efficient, more connected network moving forward. And I see in Move MN a lot of hope that transportation improvements will be recognized as a really influential factor in retaining recent college grads and young professionals. I can speak not only as a student, but as a student of geography and say that it's an established fact. Recent college graduates and young professionals are moving to cities based on the quality of life that they want. We're not following economic opportunities anymore. We're creating our own based on where we want to live and where we want to thrive and contribute to a strong community and strong economy. And the Twin Cities are doing great in greater Minnesota, but there's a lot of room to improve. I think that, recent college graduates and young professionals are prioritizing diverse transportation options as a huge piece of that quality of life. And I know that when I hear my roommate say her dream job is one that she can bike to and from work every day, I think that's a pretty strong sign of where my cohort is moving and where college-educated individuals would like to be and would like to be contributing to something more with our education and our experience. So I guess I would just like to conclude by asking the committee to pass a comprehensive transportation funding bill in 2014 because I believe that ensuring my generation with better transportation options are coming is really crucial to retaining talent in this region. And I really look forward to moving back when I can live without a car. And if you saw my student loans, you would understand why. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Ms. Gertkin.
Thank you. And I do want to mention that I have some handouts here. I don't know if there's a staff who can disseminate them. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jody Gertkin, and I am the coordinator of BLEND, a childhood obesity prevention initiative funded by the Central Care Health Foundation in St. Cloud. And I'm here today to testify as part of the Move Minnesota Coalition. You may be asking yourselves, who is Central Care Health, and moreover, why are they a part of the Transportation Coalition? The answer is very simple. While transportation solutions such as bike ped options are, of course, not the silver bullet to Minnesota's healthcare conundrum, they do need to be a part of the solution. At Central Care, health is at our core.
Our mission is to improve the health of every patient every day. We are striving to do so by making healthy choices the easiest choices for our patients and in our communities. Our not-for-profit healthcare system includes 5 hospitals, 6 nursing homes, senior housing in 6 communities, and 17 clinics throughout central Minnesota. Since 2006, the CentraCare Health Foundation, which is the philanthropic arm of our system, has provided more than $1 million in grant funds to the Blend Better Living Exercise Nutrition Daily initiative to lead a multifaceted community coalition to combat the alarming epidemic of childhood obesity. As a regional healthcare provider, CentraCare supports improved transportation infrastructure to allow our patients easier access to our facilities and quicker, safer transport using emergency medical transportation. Our roads need to be conduits and not barriers for patients. We see working with a diverse group of non-traditional stakeholders advocating for transportation funding as just as critical to job growth and economic competitiveness, but moreover, the overall health of central Minnesotans. As a leading healthcare institution, we are well aware that 80% of health happens outside of our clinics and facilities. A majority of our health is determined by our built environments and our communities and neighborhoods, the policies and systems in our schools and work sites, and the personal choices we make in our home. Our expertise, as you would expect, is in the healthcare world. However, given all the new modifications involved with healthcare reform, we are very aware we need to think differently about just primarily caring for the sick. We also need to think more proactively about what we can do to keep our communities healthy. As an example, through the leadership of Blend, we very successfully have partnered with local municipalities on the passages of complete streets policies, sidewalk ordinances, and safe routes to school grant applications. In fact, we are leading a multi-city, multi-county, multi-school safe routes to school initiative to increase the knowledge and application of the 5 E's: education, enforcement, encouragement, evaluation, and infrastructure. Sartell is a good example of a city that is prioritizing active transportation. The first handout I provided shows a map of their planned bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure and the resources that are needed to achieve their goal. Many communities in greater Minnesota have embarked on similar active transportation planning, and the new state resources that would be made available through the Move Minnesota proposal would help achieve their goals. There is growing momentum across the state for incorporating active transportation into our communities. The Statewide Health Improvement Program, also known as SHIP, has helped 66 communities make changes to increase biking and walking. For an example, the city of Fergus Falls and Frazee have adopted complete streets policies, as well as the SHIP has helped 160 schools implement safe routes to school programs that make walking and biking to and from school easier for over 68,000 students. This legislation is good on all fronts. CentraCare Health supports active transportation policy solutions and comprehensive plans which consider both preventative health measures for our constituents, as well as the demands facing our patients and chronic, acute, and emergent needs of our hospitals, clinics, and specialty care centers. Therefore, we feel it's crucial that Minnesota continues its commitment to comprehensive transportation funding, which includes long-term sustainable funding for bike and walking community infrastructure. Finally, I have one more handout for you. Across Minnesota, 10 communities have been recognized as bicycle-friendly communities. Impressively, 7 of those are in greater Minnesota. The handout provided to you includes statements of support from mayors and a planning commission from 3 of those communities. With that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sulem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. I'm being joined by 2 town officers who are going to take my time. I promise we're not going to triple your testimony.
All right.
They're just here to take real people testimony. I'm just going to give a very quick overview of why the Minnesota Association of Townships is solidly on board with the Move Minnesota effort. As you know, we have 56,000 miles of road at the township level, more than any other road authority in the state. We have 6,000 bridges. In this past year, we had the good news of taking 60 of those bridges off the state deficiency list. We were able to replace 60 bridges. Sounds like great news. Problem is, we put 62 on. We are losing ground on the battle to fix the infrastructure in the state at the township level. We have the roads that service the farms, that service the scenic areas, that service the wilderness areas, all those sorts of things. And we need the revenues to keep that up. We have 316 of our townships that have signed a resolution of support for doing this bill this year. I have one complete sack of those resolutions for the committee's record. I have a complete roster for everybody, so you can see where your communities fall on that, if staff could pick that up. With that, I am simply going to turn it over to my two town officers, and to make life easy on the committee, they're both named Gary.
Welcome, Gary.
My name is Gary Brugenthies. I'm the Wheatland Township Treasurer, and I thank you, Chair Dibble and Chair Hornstein, for having us here today. I always knew I was a real people. This is the first time I've ever been called a real people, so thank you. Wheatland Township is in Rice County, about 60 miles south of where we sit right here. It's probably the first-tier county. My job is to write the checks. I'm the treasurer, so I'm a numbers guy. And as I was kind of preparing for today, I kind of figured out that at least 75% of our budget is spent on road maintenance. Mr. Sundquist called it earlier. He said that's the less sexy part of road and bridge. I kind of like that phrase. We don't have any new expansion. It's just strictly road maintenance, and that's where most of our money goes. Something that Commissioner Zelli pointed out today, he said one of his initiatives was enhanced financial effectiveness. In the township government, we call that being frugal. At home, I would call that being cheap. And so what we've done to kind of support that is we're always looking for ways to pinch or to squeeze 6 cents out of a nickel. We're looking at concrete versus crushed concrete versus gravel, subs versus employees. We're looking at new versus used, rent versus buy. And why? Because our constituents don't communicate to us by email or mail or by phone. My constituents knocks on my door. We need something. That adds a lot of pressure and accountability to what I do. That's grassroots politics. And sometimes that can be a lot of pressure. One of the things that we've done over the last 10 years is we've tried to use the Band-Aid approach. Commissioner Zelli talked about that, too, just getting by with the least you can. And we've tried that. It doesn't work. The last couple of years, we've been trying to make up for that. The lesson that we learned, and something that Commissioner Zelli said, too, was the longer you wait, the more it costs. Last year, we had to cash in one of our CDs in order to make ends meet, and that makes my constituents a little bit nervous. In closing, I just want to say I'm as Republican as anybody in this room is. I'm always considered the tax a four-letter word. But in this situation, I don't. I look at it as more of a user fee, and I really think that we need this. We need to move on with this in Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Just to make a point, it isn't hard to be a Republican because I'm the last one here. So the percentages are in your favor.
I'll go.
The percentages are definitely in your favor.
Keeping the faith, Senator Osbeck. I appreciate it. Gary number two.
I am Gary number two. Gary Burdorf from Green Isle Township, Sibley County. You'll be glad to know that I'm going to be a little shorter than the other Gary here.
All right.
But he wasn't long. But the commissioner from Redwood Falls said before about the gravel, and that's kind of what we do in township roads. We don't see concrete. We don't see much tar. But the gravel, and he said in 99 it was like $3 a yard. I looked before I came today just at a record I had laying home, and it was in 05. It depends where you are from the pit, but our gravel cost us $8.25 a yard. In last year, in 2013, it was $10.48 a yard. I'm not a numbers guy, but I think that's around 27% of a raise. It's getting tough to answer the phone and say, why isn't there gravel? Why didn't you get it done? If there isn't, the money isn't there, it's tough. There's been big changes in the agriculture area. Everything is bigger. It used to be, you know, big wagons. Well, now they're even bigger wagons. There's lots of semis. They're moving in and out grain. Manure haulers are big machines, unbelievable. Looks like an airplane, you know, the landing gear coming down the road. Machinery has all gotten bigger, and our roads are 5-ton roads. They aren't built for that, and it takes more gravel. The township roads, we need township roads to get to the cities here, to the tar roads, and in return, the people in the cities need our township roads to get out to the lakes, do the hunting, and whatever they do, parks, things out there. So other things that have changed, 25 years ago I started driving a school bus for Sibley East District 2310. I think it was about a 50-passenger bus we drove. Now I've got a 77-passenger bus. This year, maybe in spring, with all the snow we've had, we may have to we might have to shut down because of muddy roads, not enough gravel for the safety of kids. I think that's about all I have, and I thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you very much. All right, moving on.
Could we just clarify the handout?
Mr. Sillman, yeah, what is this handout?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, the handout is a list of the townships that have signed a specific resolution of support to date. We continue to get more and more in. I have the actual a copy of the actual resolutions here. We've got one copy for the record. It's all I could get done in time for this hearing, but that is a list of all the townships statewide that have signed on to this resolution supporting the funding concept that you are hearing today.
Great. Thank you. All right. I have Jeff Reed, Nancy Showweiler, and Steve Peck. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for your patience.
Chairman and committee members, my name is Jeff Reed. I live in New London, Minnesota. I work for MnDOT. I've been working for MnDOT for 38 years. And I am the person who does soils testing, the roadway testing that's put on the roadways. Our roads were built back in the 70s and 80s. So all the subgrades on these roads are very poor. They need to be redone, and we need the money to do that. We haven't had that in the last past years. But good roadways that we need will create new jobs and will keep jobs and businesses running in our areas. In greater Minnesota, that is how we get place to place, from town to town. We use roads. Without those roads being in good shape, we will not be able to do so. That means our businesses will be moving and other jobs will be created in other ways, but we need the better roads. As other people have said, the roads that we have are failing in ways that we cannot control. The weather and our infrastructures that we have not had the money to control how these roads are being built. On our farms, I know we had about four different farm accidents in the last few years because of the large pieces of equipment we have. We have a couple of bridges that they can't go over. They can't transfer over these bridges, so they have to drive 20 to 30 miles on our public roads. They're getting into more unsafe reasons to keep this going on. We're getting accidents with these big pieces of equipment, and people are getting injured severely on this. So otherwise, I thank you for your response and our help. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Joint Committee. I am Nancy Schuweiler, Dakota County Commissioner for District 4, which includes portions of Eagan, Invergrove Heights, and Rosemount. I am also the legislative lead for the Dakota County Board of Commissioners and a member of the County Transit Improvement Board. On behalf of the Dakota County Board, I appreciate the opportunity to share our thoughts on transportation funding and the leased motor vehicle sales tax. Dakota County has consistently supported an array of transportation funding increases to address statewide and regional transportation needs that include deteriorating transportation infrastructure, growing congestion, a goal of promoting job growth and economic development, the build-out and operation of the regional transitway system, and provide enhanced transit and multimodal alternatives. Dakota County views the leased motor vehicle sales tax as a critical component of a comprehensive funding package to help meet both Minnesota and Dakota counties' growing transportation needs. In the Governor's Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, or TFAC, work completed about a year ago, Minnesota's transportation needs were identified at more than $50 billion over the next 20 years. The leased motor vehicle sales tax is an existing revenue source generated by transportation system users. It just makes sense to dedicate all leased motor vehicle sales tax revenues, including the $32 million currently directed to the general fund, to transportation purposes. This is a first step toward addressing transportation needs without raising taxes. For these reasons, the Dakota County Board of Commissioners strongly support directing all leased motor vehicle sales tax for transportation purposes. The Dakota County Board also views the leased motor vehicle sales tax as an important funding source to help meet our county's transportation needs. Like other counties around the state, our local roads are aging. They will need considerable maintenance and replacement in the future. But unlike many Minnesota counties, we are also facing significant growth over the next 20 years. We expect 100,000 new residents in Dakota County, resulting in significant transportation capacity challenges, including the need for more than 30 miles of new county highways to serve developing areas, and more than 120 miles of our county highways expected to be under capacity by 2030 without additional funding. Even as transitway development increases, the vast majority of new investments in Dakota County will be in highways. Unlike some of the more urban counties, transit in Dakota County is likely to run on highways rather than rail. Without additional highway investment, serving our growing transit needs will become a more significant challenge. The TFAC report identified a statewide funding gap of $18 billion to meet county highway needs over the next 20 years. That is $900 million annually. This gap is clearly evident in Dakota County, where we face a funding gap of nearly $500 million through 2030, or $25 million per year to meet our county highway needs alone. Even significant increases in the Highway User Trust Fund revenues distributed through the CASA Fund will not nearly keep pace with Dakota County needs. While this is an important revenue source for many counties across the state, a 10-cent gas tax increase results in $2.83 million of new revenue annually to Dakota County per the adopted AMC formula, or one-tenth of our estimated highway needs. We view the leased motor vehicle sales tax as an important component of a transportation funding package that can help meet needs of Dakota County and other suburban counties with similar highway needs. In closing, on behalf of the Dakota County Board of Commissioners, I urge you to support dedication of all leased motor vehicle sales tax to transportation purposes and the continuation of the 50-50 split between suburban county highways and Greater Minnesota Transit, including removal of the $9 million cap amount available to suburban counties in 2014 and 2015. I thank you for your time today and would be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Schuweiler. Appreciate your being here and waiting this long to testify. I'm sorry. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to, curious, you've imposed the wheels tax, I think, you haven't you in Dakota County?
Yes, we have.
At the new rate?
I believe so.
Can you give me any idea what that's going to produce?
3.2 million dollars.
So that's almost as much as the gas tax. It's more. It's more, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. So you got a big boost by doing that, helping yourselves there.
Yeah. Yes, we did.
Good.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Peck.
Thank you. Hello, members of the committee. My name is Steve Peck, and I am a 39-year-old resident of Linwood Township, Minnesota, in rural Anoka County. Linwood Township is an unincorporated community near the cities of Wyoming and Forest Lake. It is about 30 miles from St. Paul, and I also suffer from Asperger, post-traumatic stress, and schizoaffective disorders. These are permanent and total disabilities. And because of these disabilities, I do not drive, cannot afford a vehicle, and I cannot hold on a job, and I also have low income through government assistance. I can take the bus, however, but only in the cities. So I have wanted to speak out about the lack of public transportation in the rural areas of the Twin Cities for some time. In my area of Anoka County, we have no public transportation. Chautauqua and Isani counties have the Heartland Express. And although the Heartland Express is a more developed transit system than anything in the area, it is far behind the efficiency of the Metro Transit in Minneapolis and St. Paul, for instance. We have no such system in Linwood Township or East Bethel, which is our neighboring community. In order to gain access to the Metro Transit buses, one must either go to Forest Lake in the morning or Blaine. This, I believe, is terribly inefficient for those who do not have vehicles or who have a disability but need the bus or light rail trains to access where they need to go. I also believe that this inefficiency is a terrible disservice to those who have a disability or do not own a vehicle, like myself, who want to go to the store or to the bowling alley or to the movies for that matter. Hence, this is my argument. We desperately need more buses, well, need buses and trains in general that can assist those with disabilities and those who cannot otherwise drive to a certain point of interest, well, and or trains. I will point out some of the benefits of this. First, it will help get people from point A to point B faster and with more ease. More people can take the bus at once, and buses can even circumvent traffic jams on the freeways by legally using the shoulder lanes. Second, a well-developed mass transit system is integral to the community in the way that it can bring people together. For example, if a person from St. Paul wanted to see her grandmother in Forest Lake, for instance, and did not have her own vehicle, transit would be an economical way of getting her to see her grandmother. Also, transit fare is by far radically cheaper than buying gasoline for your own vehicle. Third, by bringing people from different areas of the community to other areas of the community at large, this can help the local economy. Let me explain. Say some folks wanted to go to the Minnesota State Fair and wanted to take public transportation to get there from North Branch. They have a disability and do not drive themselves but can take the bus. That could bring economy to Falcon Heights, and the same thing can happen if someone wanted to shop in Forest Lake. What goes around comes around, or North Branch, for instance. A good mass transit system can do wonders. I could also explain the environmental benefits, but that is not for this discussion at this time. But I hope you can see the positive aspects in an expanded mass transit system. This concludes my presentation. Thank you for listening. Great.
Thank you, Mr. Peck.
Thank you.
We have two additional folks who have requested to testify, Bob Carney and Leslie Davis.
Sherry
Money.
Looks like she was planning to
test.
Oh,
okay.
Sherry Money.
Sherry Money.
Here,
why don't
thank you, Bob Carney.
Sherry, we'll have you wrap up. Okay, Bob.
Sherry will go last.
Okay.
Yeah.
Carney.
Hi, Bob Carney, Minneapolis. One of the things that comes out of this for me is that there is a kind of a coalition of the status quo here. And we're talking about, for the sales tax alone, 0.75 cents, $330 million, that's pretty close to the entire budget for the Metro Transit. At the same time, you know, we're hearing, you know, $200 million for a tunnel in Minneapolis. But we're also hearing from rural Minnesota, and people are really scraping by here. You know, it's, gravel costs are tough. So, you know, we have a very challenging situation, and what I'm promoting is that we need to have some revolutionary thinking. We need to rethink our transit at a very fundamental level. I'm talking about smaller vehicles, five-minute service. This is something I'm going to be communicating with the legislators here. You are the decision makers. But we absolutely need to rethink this. What we can't afford to do is to continue along the line of the status quo. I'm in favor of holding harmless Met Transit at the current levels, but we absolutely need to get a new cost structure going forward beyond this. We cannot support what we're doing, you know, 20 years in these corridors of commerce and just an incremental increase at the current level. We need to have a transit system in the short term, 5 years from now, that will be able to provide people with the choice not to have a car throughout the metro area, throughout inside the Beltway. And that's what I'm working on, and I hope that both the Democrats and Republicans will work with me on this.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Carney. Mr. Davis.
Well, Leslie Davis, Minneapolis. When I heard this was a joint hearing, I decided I'd bring along some cigarette papers in case we need them at some point. So, and I also brought along the silver bullet.
The medicinal marijuana hearing later.
And the silver bullet is not some new strain of weed. It's the money plan, originally created by Byron Dale, backed up by Gregory Soderbergh, and I'm the delivery boy. Basically, in a minute or a minute and a half, what the money plan does, it allows the law that you already have in place, the powers of Minnesota state-chartered banks, to modify that so that state-chartered banks are required to create electronic checkbook money to pay for all approved road and bridge projects and their maintenance, city, county, township, and state. Then you could take that $1 billion in taxes that are generated and do whatever you want with them. You could spend them elsewhere. You could pass legislation to just give it back to the people that have been putting up the money. So I gave you this little one-pager that will explain simply what it does. And what it will do is make Minnesotans wealthy and healthy and put everybody to work with no debt or taxes. Thanks a lot for the chance to speak.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Davis. And bringing us home, we have Sherry Mudd.
Mr. Chairman, members, Sherry Munyon representing the Minnesota Public Transit Association. We are also members of Move Minnesota and support a comprehensive transportation funding package this year, 2014. I'm going to make some comments on behalf of Greater Minnesota Transit, just reminding members that there are 80 counties outside of the metro area where citizens are also looking for transit. Only a handful of Greater Minnesota communities have evening and weekend service. 9 counties in the state of Minnesota have only limited municipal service, and we have 1 county who still has no transit service, public transit service at all. 62% of the Greater Minnesota households have incomes of $20,000 or less. 51% of those have no driver's license. 33% of the transit riders in Greater Minnesota take trips to work, and another 20% are going to school. One of the things that we've talked about today is equity in funding. Representative Hausman has raised that issue. We understand that concern, but I think a couple of facts we'd like to have on the table are how current resources are used. For instance, in Greater Minnesota today, $16 million of general fund money go to support our rural bus service. But in the metro area, we have about $35 million for metro transit and nearly another $30 million for metro mobility. So you can see that's not comparable as we take a look at the population in Greater Minnesota compared to the metro area. We don't have something that looks like a 50-50 split. When the legislature passed the motor vehicle sales tax distribution, it was divided 60-40, 40% transit. And out of the 40% for transit, that was not divided by any type of equitable formula. It was not divided by population, and it was not divided by where the revenue came from. If you would have divided the MVEST for Greater Minnesota Transit based on revenue source, it would have been a split that looked like 21-19, not 36-4. Had you based that split based on population, the distribution would have been 22-18. So now we have the last source of funding that we're looking at this year, lease vehicle revenue. And as you heard, the 5 metro counties are looking for a distribution of that $32 million of 50-50. If you base the distribution of those $32 million by population, it would be 80-20. So as you deliberate a funding bill, we would encourage you to strongly take a look at meeting the needs of Greater Minnesota, this year and moving us forward. The transportation plan calls for meeting 80% of the need by 2015, and we're going to be at about 62% of that need. So we look forward to visiting with you in the future on this. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Munyon. All right. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Chairs. I'd be remiss if I didn't join the passionate debate we've had here for several hours and being a strong advocate for transportation, not only in my district, but throughout the state. I've heard a lot about the commentary in the passionate debate of West versus East, rural versus metro, and all the different proposals being a 300 increase on this or the 300 increase on that and all the different numbers that are flying our way. I've been in the legislature 1 year, and I've just really come to observe in my 1 year here is that we can't let the perfect be, you know, the enemy of progress. We can't let perfect be the enemy of the good. And I think when we're having this discussion today, whether it's Representative Mahoney's adequate insight into how are we addressing the East Metro needs, I think these are all great considerations to have, but I think we also have been waiting and waiting and talking and talking, and this 3-plus-hour hearing is quite evident of that. I think it's time for action, and I support the coalition. I support a comprehensive package and hopefully getting people like Representative Mahoney and Senator Osmick and everybody on board, because the needs are there. The facts are there. They're not going away. You can hide from them, but they're not going to go away. So again, I urge members to think of progress and don't let perfect be the enemy of it.
Senator Osmick, take us home.
Mr. Chair, just a simple question. Now that I have you both of the esteemed chairs in the room, do we have a bill in our future? Because I would like to see the bill as soon as possible. I know we've had two committee hearings, joint committee hearings, and time this year is going to be short, or at least that's what we're told. I'd like to know, is there a game plan on the Senate side or on the House side or any side as far as when are we going to see something?
You bet, Senator Osmick.
There will More be than that, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair.
There will be a bill, and it will be heard. So,
but no timeline?
Remains to be seen.
Okay.
Watch the committee hearing postings closely.
I'll watch my email.
All right. And I'll be working also with your Republican lead to keep him well informed as well and draw folks into informal conversations if need be. Great. So, members, I think that draws us to a close. Thank you. 3 hours and 17 minutes. That's good, healthy airing of the issues. So one quick announcement, actually two announcements. We're not done yet, members and audience. The Center for Transportation Studies seminar is, in fact, scheduled. It's going to be Thursday, February 27th from 5 to 8:15 over at the McNamara Alumni Center. We will probably give you both paper and email notices, at least on the Senate side, but I'm hearing that the email's back up. So,
or carrier pigeon?
Carrier pigeon, messenger. And members, I just want to also let you know that, I'm sorry.
Is that event just for legislators?
Yeah. Legislators and staff, yeah.
And so why don't they have it here so that we don't all have to travel there?
We went back and forth. If we need to arrange for transportation, we will. But it's off-site, so we can kind of focus our minds, and they're serving dinner, and you know, kind of like last year's event. That seemed to be
in 2 hours.
It seemed to work out pretty well last year, so we thought we'd go with that same model. It was well attended, enjoyed.
What day is that?
They can serve dinner on the site and that sort of thing. So, but if we need to arrange for efficient transportation, it's not that far away. So. Just down the street. All right. Members, we're going to be in session, of course, next Tuesday, but someone is not going to be with us next Tuesday. Mr. Gordon is moving with his husband to San Diego, where the weather is so boring. I can't understand why he's doing that. So this is his last hearing with us after 6 years of service to the Senate and the people of Minnesota. So.
what they say about San Diego. Never too hot, never too cold.
Yeah, boring, yeah. It's ridiculous. Publicly, thank you. I think everyone agrees on, you know, in the community and on either side of the aisle and, you know, everyone everywhere has for years been very, very complimentary of the amazing, amazing service. And members, you don't even know the half of what he has done and the major force he has been in moving very, very significant policy and historic change. People should know that. So, it's I should stop talking. I'm not going to be able to talk in a second. Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering, did we have counsel here today? There were a couple of questions.
Representative Earhart, I'm
they were hiding in the back.
Let me finish here for a second.
Don't they usually let them sit at the table so we know they're here?
Ms. Gordon, did you have anything you want to share? No. Yeah, I didn't think so. But thank you, and you know, please give him your thanks as he makes his way to San Diego. Representative Earhart, you'd have a point you wanted to make?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I asked you if there was counsel here today.
Yeah,
there were
the
some
back.
Questions for. But they were hiding back there, and we didn't know. Usually let them sit at the table so that we know they're here, in case you have another meeting.
Thank you. Anything else, members? All right. With that, we're adjourned, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
But isn't that interesting? I mean, I don't know if you read this back here.